Bruneman, please come up to the front.
With your name and address on it for $300 and my picture, what do you think?
Modify the gun so it has my name on it.
I like the part where I can tool over in the liquor store in San Francisco. By the time I get across the Bay Bridge to Oakland, my gun no longer is the same gun.
Yeah, right.
I've changed the firing pin, the barrel, the tractor.
I heard a story in Las Vegas.
And the others are somewhere in San Francisco Bay as well.
Right.
I heard a story in Las Vegas you might be interested in. Haven't had it corroborated, but a guy who was accosted by a large fella, tried to rob him, pulled out his little pistol and shot him in
my car.
Nate said it was a big thing because it was in a big area, right, and everything. Guy sat down, went out, rubber gloves, bought paper, envelope, everything, wrote down the incident, how it happened, sent in the firing pin and the barrel of the firearm, and closed the case.
Nothing.
The guy was a felon, had a history of robbery.
Sounds normal. Those interesting birds. I like those.
Do we have any chapters near this man, Brandon?
Is that him? Yeah. Be surprised you go out there and really try it.
There we go. Good morning. Welcome to the California Fish and Game Commission meeting of Friday, June 8th in Truckee, California. I'd like to make a few introductions to get us started. Myself, I'm Cindy Gustafson. I'm Vice President of the Commission. To my left is Jim Kellogg from Concord, California. Judd Hanna to my right, Commissioner from Mill Creek, California. And on his right is Michael Sutton, our newest commissioner from Monterey, California. Our commission staff here today, we have John Fisher, a deputy executive director, and Adriana Shea, a deputy executive director. John Carlson is just walking in the room as our executive director. Sherry Cole, Sean Cubbage, and Sherry Tiemann, all our analysts for the commission. We also have with us this morning Ryan Broderick, director of Department of Fish and Game, Sankey Mastrip, Deputy Director, Chief Foley, Nancy Foley.
Who did I miss?
Oh, John McCammon. Sorry, John. Chief Deputy Director. And we also have Rob Allen down at the end of the table and Eric Loft, who's Chief of our Wildlife Branch. Have I missed anyone? Oh, Steve Marcherano with the Office of Communications for the department. Great, thank you very much. I understand that Steve Matthew from AGP Video, who does a great job live streaming our commission meetings and making sure we're transparent to the public, wanted to make a quick announcement this morning. Steve.
Good morning, board and staff and the world at large.
My name is Steve Matthew. I am CEO of AGP Video. We have been live streaming for over 3 years with your board, the Fish and Game Commission. We have been videotaping and broadcasting in San Luis Obispo County and statewide on the California channel for some time, and making available on DVDs or tape, depending upon how long ago it was, all of these meetings. You are one of the first state board meetings, commission meetings, that has enjoyed this transparency, and I'm real proud to be a part of that. And actually glad that you guys got on board with it and embraced it. What I wanted to say was yesterday was a real hard day for blackberries. In a perfect world, we would all be shutting off our cell phones for these meetings, but as we all know, that's really not practical. What I have learned about the blackberries, however, is that it's a sympathetic frequency, it's a radio thing, and it's a proximity to microphones. So if you can keep your blackberries as far away from the microphones as you possibly can, we can still all do this and not have that nasty chatter noise in the back. I would also like to thank the board and staff for how hard they worked and how fast to bring this commission on board and write a contract with us. The first 4 years, we actually enjoyed a grant from a group out of San Luis Obispo County, the Central Coast Cable Fisheries Liaison Committee. That grant funding dried up, and Mr. Carlson and his staff were Johnny on the spot. They got all over writing a contract to continue the services. This is the first meeting on that contract. So you guys are self-sufficient. I'm working for you and the people of California. So thank you again, and have a good meeting.
Thank you very much, Steve. You're doing a great job for us, you and the whole crew back there in the back of the room.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. On behalf of the staff and the commission, we're really glad you're here. We can now say you've been assimilated, which is, you know. I'd like to make a housekeeping announcement. If you're interested in speaking this morning on any of the agenda items, please turn in a speaker card. They're in the hallway. Turn it in at the end of the dais up here, and the time set for each speaker will be 3 minutes, to a maximum of 10 minutes total for the day. With that,
sure. Yesterday we had quite a bit of discussion on the Truckee River, and one of the most important partners in the Truckee River is our Truckee River Watershed Council here in Truckee, California. Lisa Wallace, the executive director of that group, was unable to be in town yesterday. She was out of town, but I did ask if we could allow her 10 or 15 minutes to do a quick presentation on the Truckee River and the great things their organization is doing. So, Lisa,
great.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cindy, and thank you to all the commissioners and to everyone here in the audience today and everybody out in webland. It's terrific that we're being webcast. I'm going to bring up some information packets for the commissioners and for the staff. And if anybody, I'm sorry I didn't bring enough for folks here, but if you're interested later, you can let me know, and I'm happy to get you information. With a little bit of luck from technology, I'll have a PowerPoint up in just a minute. But while that's coming up, let me just say I'm really pleased to be here. We do work very closely with a lot of the resource agencies in the Truckee River watershed. Again, I'm Lisa Wallace, the executive director of the Truckee River Watershed Council. We're a nonprofit organization. We're based very locally in Truckee. We work on the Truckee River watershed from the outflow of Lake Tahoe to the state line at Nevada. And then, of course, all the creeks and streams that flow into that area. It's about 435 square miles. We were founded in 1996 as an all-volunteer organization. And this is a great time for me to recognize Ray Butler, who was one of the founding members of the organization, really instrumental in keeping us honest all the way through. In 2001, we transitioned to an organization with a paid staff person, and that was me. Since then, we've expanded a little bit in terms of staff, but we've greatly expanded in terms of the number of projects that we're doing. We focus on water quality protection and habitat restoration related to riparian zones, meadows, and wetlands. What I wanted to do this morning is just talk about two projects in particular. Sorry, Jim, did you need to get to the folks in the back? Great. I can hear it too. So,
you couldn't hear any better than I could.
I just wanted to talk about two projects that illustrate the kind of work that we do and how we do it through partnerships and with participation of the community. In the newsletter that I just handed out to the staff and the commissioners, on the front page of that is an article about the Purrazzo Meadows Acquisition and Restoration Project. We partnered with the Truckee Donner Land Trust and with the U.S. Forest Service as the primary cooperators in obtaining a grant to do an acquisition in the Purrazzo Meadows system. That's an acquisition of one of the last remaining inholdings from a willing seller. We'll also do an assessment in that meadow system, and we'll do a restoration project. The California Department of Fish and Game, through Susan Levitsky and Bill Summer, were critical in helping us obtain the grant money to do that. We received the grant through one of the state water bond and restoration grants. The reason I really like to talk about that project is some of you will remember back in time many years ago to the Sierra Nevada Ecosystem Project. The Purrazzo Meadow System was recognized through SNEP as one of the most critical meadow systems in the northern Sierra Nevada. It received the highest priority ranking. That's because of its potential as a fishery and its terrific habitat potential for the willow flycatcher. And as we all know, those the fishery and the willow flycatcher are indicators, if they're functioning well, for the health of the whole system. But it was also identified in SNEP and through other planning documents subsequently that the system was failing. It was not functioning either as a substantial fishery or to provide other riparian and meadow habitat. So again, working from that point in time till now, we were able to apply for a grant, get some funding. Thank you very much. Get some funding. And we've now actually started implementing the assessment project. So again, we're focusing on, in this case, this is a great example of an area ranked highly by various studies from both the state of California and the Forest Service as critical habitat, partnership with the nonprofit agency, the Watershed Council, my group, with the Forest Service, and with another nonprofit, the Truckee Donner Land Trust, in terrific cooperation with the California Department of Fish and Game. So we're excited about the project. The acquisition is moving forward with the willing seller at an appropriate pace. We've been able to launch the assessment, as I said, which will direct for us the restoration projects. And in 2008 and 2009, we'll actually start implementing the restoration. Another part of that project that we're really proud of is that we're doing monitoring, both to assess water quality, the kind of the current conditions now, and what impact we'll have over time on water quality, but also various indicators of habitat, vegetation, and species. And we don't often get to do this caliber of monitoring with restoration projects, and we really appreciate all agencies at the state that are supportive of that kind of monitoring. Could I ask who's ever appropriate to let me know when I've got maybe about 2 minutes left of my 10 or so? Thanks. I know you guys have a lot to cover today. So, we can see Ray here in the picture. This is the point in time where we transitioned from an all-volunteer organization to a staffed organization. A terrific set of volunteers helped us get to this point, and this is our new board of directors. I mentioned that our mission and values are to protect and restore the Truckee River watershed. It's a very high priority for us to be doing work that's ecologically sound. That really leads to my terrific appreciation, great appreciation for being able to do monitoring. I've talked about partnerships, one example, through the Purrazzo Meadows Project. We also recognize that in our watershed, the basis of our economy is really tied to the health of the system. Both its aesthetic health, it's beautiful, that's why people want to come up here, but also because of the recreation economy, how we're functioning, how the watershed functions. So, for example, having a healthy fishery, having people be able to recreate. We do water quality monitoring. We have one volunteer group called Truckee River Aquatic Monitors. They go out and do habitat assessment, but they also actually collect macroinvertebrates, the water bugs in the stream, and assess the health of a given stream based on the macroinvertebrates. Many of you in this room know that the macroinvertebrates are a good indicator for watershed health because they reflect the conditions of the watershed over time. Truckee River Day is an annual river restoration day. A big event for us every October. This year will be our 12th Truckee River Day. And we're also starting to do many larger scale restoration projects. I mentioned Prazo Meadows earlier as an example of that. Just a little bit about our watershed. There are 7 dams on our system, 6 listed waters. When we say 2 clear cuts, we mean over the 150 years that the Truckee River watershed has had active resource use, all the forests in the area have been cut down completely twice. That's not unusual in the Sierra Nevada, particularly in areas where there was heavy mining or railroads come through. But it leaves a lot of legacy issues for us. And then we're at, and as you all know, an extensive transportation corridor with I-80. The reason the Watershed Council exists, there's not any one agency that's responsible for the entire health of the watershed. Government agencies, state, local, and federal, are appropriately, in our mind, appropriately restricted in their scope. There's oftentimes budget constraints and staff constraints. The Watershed Council can identify and bring together all the partners for a given project or problem to get it resolved. Just a little bit about our financial status. As you can see from the pie chart, we rely heavily on state and federal grants to do our restoration projects. I'm going to skip over some of the next set of slides. Just don't watch them. You'll get dizzy. And I want to talk about a specific project that we did again with California Department of Fish and Game. And I'll wrap up after talking about that project. So I'm going to blitz through some slides here. These are examples of, as you can tell, of some of the restoration projects that we've done over the past few years. And I'm fast-forwarding to this project, the Martis Creek Spawning Gravel Project. This is a project we started implementing in 2004, continued again in 2005. It was successful enough that we're actually going to try another couple of sites this year and next year. Martis Creek has a dam on it, Martis Dam. Downstream of the dam, from the dam to the main stem of the Truckee River, is considered to be a great spawning area for brown trout and rainbow trout. A few years ago, the Tahoe Truckee fly fishers, some of whom are in the audience today, came to the Watershed Council and said, "We've been fishing this reach of Martis Creek, we think we're seeing a decrease in spawning. We haven't done a study. This is our anecdotal experience. We're out here a lot. We see that the creek is functioning in a healthy way. There's good overhang. There's enough flow. The water temperature is good. But, of course, gravel recruitment isn't happening because of the dam, which has now been in place for decades, is holding gravel. Could we do a gravel placement project? Could we do an experiment? Could we try placing gravels in the creek and see, does it work? Do we see, again, an increase in spawning? Does the gravel stay in place? Can we figure out, is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? This, of course, is a manual fix to a problem. We're not going to have Martis Dam come out anytime soon. On the other, if ever, that's not code for saying it might be coming out sometime soon. We recognize it's a relatively permanent fixture in the system. On the other hand, we don't want to lose what we think is very good spawning habitat. So over a number of years, starting at about 2002, we started working with our local California Department of Fish and Game staff to see if we could try this project. At first, everyone was a little skeptical. You know, it's a manual fix. We're going to place these gravels. Is it going to really work? And how often are we going to have to place gravels if it does work? But we gained agreement from Fish and Game and from the Water Board to try the project. And in 2004, some really hardy souls came out Tykert Aggregates donated the rock for us. They came out. A bunch of fly fishers came out. That's Bill Summers on the left-hand side of the screen. Fish and Game staff came out and helped us actually place these gravels. In the subsequent... Is that my timer? Okay, great. I'm very close to wrapping up. In subsequent years, the 2 years after this, we also had very good water flow. So we placed the gravels. We had very good water years, good flow out of the creek. So some combination of placing the gravels and increased flows has anecdotally told us that spawning is increased. And again, this is the fly fishers coming to us, letting us know that they're seeing increased spawning. We've gone out several times with Fish and Game. We've looked at the gravels. They, you know, they're moving some, of course, but they're not moving radically. So we're going to continue to monitor Martyrs Creek here, but it's been successful enough as a pilot project that this fall in another reach in Prosser Creek, again, downstream of a dam, we're going to try placing gravels there and see how it works there. So again, I thank you for the time this morning and for accommodating me on Friday. And yeah, just wanted to let you know about a couple of our projects and really thank you for the terrific work that you do. And I really would like to appreciate your staff. They've been wonderful partners for us. Thank you.
There we go. Thank you very much, Lisa, and thanks to the department staff who've worked so closely with you. Any questions of Lisa, commissioners? Okay. Great. Thank you again for joining us this morning.
That brings us to the start of this morning's agenda. Item number 14, announcement of results from the executive session. Pursuant to 11126 of the government code, the commission held an executive session yesterday. Legal counsel participated via the phone. No appeal hearing information was heard, so no action was taken during that session. That's the end of the report.
Thank you, John. So we'll move on.
Item number 15, discussion of request to publish notice of commission intent to modify report card structure for abalone, sturgeon, steelhead, and salmon, and to establish a lobster report card. Saki Mastrup from the department will explain this.
Good morning, Commissioner. Saki Mastrup, Deputy Director of Fish and Game. Yeah, what you have before you in your binder is a proposal or a memo highlighting some recommended changes we'd like the commission to consider over the course of the next several months, and I'll summarize them briefly. The gist of the proposed concepts are any person fishing for abalone, salmon, steelhead, sturgeon, or lobster shall have in their possession a non-transferable report card. The primary purpose is to get the kind of information you've been hearing folks looking for and the information we've been seeking in various forums before you by requiring anglers pursuing those to record basic catch and location data to help us manage those fisheries. All species of those that have an annual bag limit, they'll also have a tagging requirement. For example, last year you approved the sturgeon report card, which was new for sturgeon. Along with that came a requirement to tag any retained sturgeon with a tag. We'd like to do the same thing with abalone because it also has an annual limit. It would not apply to those fisheries like salmon, steelhead, or lobster in this case, which do not have annual limits. That's largely to help enforcement enforce those provisions. The other aspect is these cards have various fees, some of which aren't recovering even basic printing costs, the report cards, so part of the proposal is to revamp some of the fee structures, some of which we can't change, the commission doesn't have authority, but some of which you do have authority. There's a revision in there to revise the salmon punch card to assist in our inland and ocean salmon harvest management. And the new card that we're asking the commission to consider is a lobster report card. Currently, there is essentially no information being gathered on lobster other than our surf sampling. And unfortunately, a lot of the lobster fishing occurs at night, and our surf sampling generally is not done at night. Given the success of the other report cards, we would be proposing requiring lobster fishermen, whether it be hoop netters or divers, to simply record their catch so we have a better way to gather critical information on effort and catch. And that's the gist of it. We're asking permission to go to notice. If you have any questions, I'll attempt to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonking. Any questions, commissioners? Okay, we have one public speaker on this item.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. You've just heard that you can't even revamp the cost of the printing of these cards. These cards were first conceived by commercial abalone fishermen because the biologist said they had no idea how many sport abalone divers there were. I pushed hard to get a stamp, not a card, so we could have the number of sport fishermen participating in that fishery. And we wanted it to cost to be able to cover the printing for a stamp. Oh, your biologists fought this because they didn't want that number of sport divers to be known. But once we got it through, they said, oh, look, we could put a punch card on here and create a burden and an unusual travesty is what has happened. It has become a public relations nightmare. You have got game wardens now that are beheaded for all times because of this, trying to enforce this unenforceable law. The number of abalones a year is 24, yet it is unenforceable. There are so many ways around it. It has burdened the system to a point where I say again, it's a public relations nightmare. We have heard from the biologists that no statistically significant information is coming out of these cards. It's not right. And rather than admit failure, they want to keep doing it some more. You cannot revamp the cost. It's a public relations nightmare. Most of it's unenforceable. You're creating great public resentment and animosity toward these things. And I don't care how much revamping or reinventing that you do, it's not going to ever conceivably bring about any information. Because, first of all, the cards aren't accurate in their depiction of the areas, the locations, and that. And then a fisherman who has an area that he likes and he doesn't want to expose to others, is he going to be honest about it on the report card? No. If you would ask the people who are filling out these report cards, have you filled it out honestly? Well, no, I just put down what they want to hear probably, and I'm not going to tell you where my best spot is or where I'm getting my largest abalones, my largest lobsters. It's a complete boondoggle, and it's unacceptable. The number of sport fishermen in that fishery is what is needed, and a price for a stamp. But the rest of it has become a public relations nightmare, and it's not acceptable. And when Jim Kellogg was president on the commission, he heard a lot of testimony about the problems, the unenforceability, the resentment that has been created, and he said he was going to look into it and try and get rid of this burden. This has not happened. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Commissioners? Any items for discussion? I think the department would like some direction from us on this.
Well, just to respond, because my name was mentioned, I have responded to the people who brought forth issues with credibility on that, and the majority of the lobster people out there are satisfied and able to work with the system that we have set up. So I commend the department for what they've done in that arena.
Do we, I'm sorry, Ryan, would you like to say?
Madam Chair, commissioners, the revamping, we are going to try to improve some of the instructions, simplify them, to clarify on those fees that can be adjusted. We'll come to you with fee increases. Many of these are statutory fees, so legislation is required. Kind of back to the discussion we had on landing taxes. I think it's important to underscore that while this system is not perfect, that the recreational harvest of species, whether it be these we're discussing this morning or in the classic case of the black bear, that information is some of the most extensive, well-distributed, and revealing in terms of assisting us in managing the fisheries. The other issue on the report card is because we've tied report cards to typically the age that needs a license. We're missing an increment on, I think, some very precious resources. Even had this suggested to us by license holders that when we're talking about lobster and mollusk and some of those animals that we're putting the annual limits on, that having the effort as well as the catch that occurs with anglers under 16 is potentially a very important component for your deliberations in the regulation process.
Thank you, Ryan. Any questions or comments from commissioners? I don't think we need a motion. You didn't ask for action, but I think we want some direction from the commission. Okay. So I'm hearing that we're fine with the department moving forward on this.
With them, then we will prepare initial statement of reasons and prepare for notice then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sankey.
Item 16 now, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 29.85, Title 14, regarding crabs. Please note that the adoption hearing for this item is scheduled for August 10th, 2007, in Santa Barbara. At this point, since this is just receipt of public testimony, there really is no DFG update. There's been no changes to this package. And as of right now, I have no speaker cards for this issue. So I guess this is the last call for public comment on this today, and, of course, commission discussion also.
Okay. Seeing no public comment, commissioners, do you have any input on this?
I do. This, to me, is just a correction of an error and probably ought to be on the consent calendar.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. We'll move on.
Moving on to item 17, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to sections 251.7, 257, 300, and 600, Title 14, regarding the possession of game birds, resident small game defined, seasons and bag limits for upland game birds, and regulations for licensed game bird clubs. Please note the adoption hearing for this is scheduled for July 13th, 2007, in Bridgeport. At this point, Dr. Eric Loft from the Department's Wildlife Branch is going to say a few words, and then we do have some public speaker cards on this.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Eric Loft with the Department's Wildlife Branch. And just to introduce where we are with the upland game, might go over real quickly some of the changes that that we're talking about making here. The first one, as it relates to possession, transportation, and importation of game birds, we're going to ask the commission to consider changing the regulation to require that a head or feathered wing be retained on all game birds while they're being transported for identification purposes. The second item would be that the department would propose that we add the Eurasian collared dove to the list of resident game birds, resident small game species, and also include the Eurasian collared dove, include the dove in the bag limit for dove. Regarding sage-grouse hunting permits, no significant changes there. Right now we're just proposing that we provide you with a range of permits to be authorized until we get our final numbers for the hunting seasons. Another item that we would propose is a youth hunting season for turkeys, an additional opportunity there in the spring. And then the final change that we would make is to modify the shooting hours on licensed game bird clubs to make them consistent with shooting hours elsewhere in the state. So that's it in a nutshell on the proposed changes that the department would go forward.
Okay. Thank you, Eric. I think Commissioner Kellogg has a question.
Well, let's go through the speaker card first,
okay.
And then I'll ask
okay.
Eric to come back.
Thank you. All right.
Don't go far, Eric. We have four speaker cards on this issue, 3 minutes apiece, please. Stan Landis, followed by Ryan Mathis, followed by Brian Burhans, followed by Walt Manziel.
Well, my name is Stan Landis. I'm from San Diego, California. My topic is on something different than what was outlined in that little agenda, but I'm here about the turkey season in San Diego County. There is no fall turkey season in San Diego County, and I believe it's the only county in the state that does not have one. About 3 years ago, I attended a meeting of a fish and game official who came to San Diego, gave us a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation about seasons and deer seasons and turkey seasons and every other season, and asked us if we were in favor of having a fall turkey hunt in San Diego. And we said, well, we would really like to have another round of regulation changes and not have a turkey season in the fall in San Diego, just to give our breeding population a chance to get it well established. We haven't done any scientific studies to establish if that has taken place or not, but our take on turkeys every year has gone up significantly in the spring, and our reports of populations of expansion is tremendous in the county. We still see no reason not to have it a fall season in San Diego County. But we were informed that this cycle was a two-year cycle. And then about a year ago, I called Fish and Game and talked to Tom and was told that the cycle had been changed to a three-year cycle. So I'm not really clear what this cycle is. I've seen no notice, public notification of meetings in San Diego County to address these issues, and I would just like to know what the status of that consideration for those changes might be. Thank you.
Ryan Mathis, followed by Brian Burhans, followed by Walt Manziel.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Ryan Mathis. I'm a regional biologist for the National Wild Turkey Federation, and I'm going to just keep this short and sweet. I probably won't take the entire 3 minutes, but I do want to speak on the proposed youth turkey season. We've done a poll of some key chapter members as well as our California board of director members, and the consensus is a support for the youth season for the weekend before the general season, and not the 2 weeks after, and or a combination of the two. This would be consistent with other states' youth season to have it for the 2 days, the week before the general season, and we feel that it'd also be it'd avoid opposition and conflicts with the archers for during that 2 weeks of the archery season. We are very supportive of this, and it will be a great opportunity for our youth to have an opportunity, especially for youth to get an opportunity to get introduced to the sport and hopefully have an added advantage for the turkey season. Thank you.
Brian Burhans, followed by Walt Manziel, followed by Bill Gaines.
Good morning. My name is Brian Burhans. I'm with the National Wild Turkey Federation out of our headquarters in Edgefield, South Carolina. At the request of staff and the chapter, I was asked to provide some data on youth turkey hunting throughout the United States as you look at this decision. First of all, the way we did this brief survey was we contacted our regional biologist staff across the country. We asked them, does your state offer a youth turkey season? How is that youth turkey season structured? We asked them about the age limits imposed on that season, and then we asked them the question of what are the problems, what are you hearing. I'd like to provide you a brief summary of this information. Number one, most states, 65% of the states in the United States, now offer a special youth season, and a youth season being defined as a period of time when you can take a youth in the field to hunt turkeys and no other individuals, adult, are permitted to hunt turkeys at that time. On average, these are offered, most states offer this for 2 days prior to the opening of the regular season, so it is done beforehand. And this seems to be the most preferred way in some of our northern states. Obviously, the weather's a little bit colder, and you hear some complaints about that. But it you have a lot more gobbling birds, and it's about, you know, the whole opportunity is about giving kids a chance and let them hear the gobble of the wild turkey. There are other states, again, 32 out of 49, do currently offer special youth turkey season. I did not obviously include Alaska in this survey since it does not have turkeys. And what was really interesting is, although before, when you get into hearings like this and people discussing youth turkey hunts. You'll hear every reason under the world of, oh, what about this and what about that. What was interesting from the survey is in the end, there was not one single case of people that were unsatisfied about the turkey hunt, the youth turkey hunt. In fact, it has been widely embraced. And I can provide my own personal testimony. I have a 12-year-old son, and he took a turkey during South Carolina's turkey youth day this year, and it is absolutely a wonderful, special time. And what you'll find by providing this opportunity before the season is diehard turkey hunters, and most of us are, we'll go searching for a youth to go take in the woods and introduce them to turkey hunting. So it's a real special time to spend time with kids. And I applaud the agency for looking at this proposal, and I think it's a very, very good opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
Walt Manziel, followed by Bill Gaines.
Chairman Gustafson, President Gustafson, or whatever title is. Commissioners, members of staff, I had a chance to review Eric's proposals briefly with him before the meeting. We support science-based management of the upland game and support generally the department's proposals. We'd take a neutral stance on the proposals of the Wild Turkey Federation, but it sounds like they are on the right track in some areas on their turkeys. We particularly appreciate the effort to reconcile the shooting hours in general seasons and on the game bird clubs, because it has been an enforcement problem when the game bird clubs have been allowed to shoot a little bit later than the regular hunters. But thank you very much.
Thanks, Walt.
Bill Gaines.
Vice President Gustafson, members of the Commission, Department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. It's a pleasure to be here today. The California Outdoor Heritage Alliance would like to offer our support to the National Wild Turkey Federation's recommendations in regards to the youth turkey season. We also believe that that should be held the weekend before the season opens, not the weekend after. It would avoid the conflicts with archers, and it would significantly enhance the chances of success for those youth in the field. So we urge the commission to strongly consider a youth turkey hunting season prior to the general season. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
That wraps up public testimony.
Okay, Commissioner Harry, Herlog.
You can respond to me from there. I support the department recommendations except for the area that Walt just supported. And that's the changing of the shooting hours on the licensed game bird clubs. I'm uncomfortable with that. I've been contacted by some of my friends that run those clubs, and it's opportunity for people who just don't have access to hunting anywhere else. And the shooting hours that are in place now have worked on those clubs for a long time, and I don't know that. I mean, you need to show me that it's that big of a enforcement issue that we need to change those hours after those clubs have been using the same hours since their existence. And so hopefully I can get the rest of the commission to support me on this, but I think that that the package in its entirety, except for item 4, the changing of the shooting hours on licensed game bird clubs, is acceptable to me, but I'd like to see that remain the way it has been for the past several years.
Commissioner Kellogg, would you like, I would at this time offer to have Rob Allen with enforcement give you some information as to why we've come up with that proposal as a department.
Okay.
Yes, Commissioners, Rob Allen, Assistant Chief with Enforcement Branch. Division. The reason behind that is for consistency. The way the regulation read prior to is it referenced section 310.05, which was in direct conflict of the wording of this regulation. The shooting hours for this upland game birds is 1/2 hour before sunrise to sunset, and the regulation specifically referenced that section, and then it went on to say it was a half hour after sunset. So what we did was we wanted consistency across the board. That way any sportsman that's hunting this type of game bird has consistency in the regulations, so there isn't any confusion when they're not out there on one of these licensed clubs. So consistency is what we were looking for, and that was the reason behind it.
I understand that, but I know how long it's worked the way it is, and I just don't agree that it's that big of a problem to keep it the way it is. So I'm going to request that the department take a look at going back on paragraph 4 and for the final adoption, leaving the licensed game bird shooting hours the way they are.
If that is the case, Commissioner, we would still have to change something in that section that would, it says pursuant to 310.05 or 0.5 in that regulation, we would have to strike that because that is inconsistent with the wording of that section.
That'd be okay. But for the rest of it, I'd like to have no change.
Other commissioner questions or comments on that? Can you turn on my mic again? Just because I'm... There we go. Okay, thank you. I did want to ask the department for a response on the youth turkey issue. Is there an issue with moving it to the beginning of the season and concern that the department might have on that?
Commissioners, the initial statement of reasons as it's currently worded, the project is described as after. The having the junior hunts after the general spring season along with the archers, we feel that's a better period for the junior hunters. The notion of conflict with archers is not all that realistic. Most of this hunting is occurring on private land, and that's certainly something that can be worked out with the landowners, so there's not conflict. To change it before the season would require re-noticing the ISOR, which means you could not adopt by July, which would make it very difficult for us to put out regulations by the upland game season. So at this point, we don't recommend that. We have vetted this fairly well and believe a junior hunting opportunity after the general spring season will not impact the resource and is a wonderful opportunity for junior hunters.
Excuse me, Commission staff wants to jump in a little bit here. There is an option to have the youth hunting season the weekend prior to the opening of the general spring season, and that is identified in the initial statement. So what kind of re-notice requirement would be there is unclear to me. It might just be a 15-day notice, but it is identified as an alternative in your initial statement.
Okay. Yeah, that's correct. We just don't have the regulatory language built for that.
Okay. Cindy, I'd like to ask a question.
Sure, go ahead, Commissioner Hanna.
Would the reasons on the hours for game bird clubs changing that be the same thing? Does that require something that holds up the process?
The proposal for the shooting hours...
I'm talking about Commissioner Kellogg's suggestion.
Yes, the proposal for shooting hours, the commission can choose not to change that and leave that as it is. We would have to look at what Rob referred to as a technical change. I think we'd look at that hopefully as a technical change, which we may be able to avoid re-notice, but that's something I need to look at in a little more detail with your staff. But obviously, delaying adoption past July is a concern of ours. So,
thank you.
We'll be looking at that very closely.
Thank you. And then, Commissioner Kellogg, is this a big deal? A lot of people contact you on this. It amounts to half an hour either way, or maybe an hour. The difference in the shooting time is perhaps an hour, maybe.
Yeah, but they've been operating like this since they opened, and people have adjusted to it that participate in those clubs, and it gives more opportunity for people, especially during the work week, to get out and back to work, and a lot of different reasons.
Thank you.
I have to say I'm a little conflicted on this one because from an enforcement perspective, many of these clubs are, you know, there's waterfowl hunting going on adjacent. There's upland bird hunting going on in the clubs. At sunset, if you're out there, having worked waterfowl hunters for years, if you're out there and you hear shots at sunset, it's very difficult to tell whether they're coming from waterfowl hunting areas or areas where people are shooting on the clubs. So I have to say I can see both sides of this one, and it's a difficult one to resolve. Half an hour, I mean, in many cases where people are shooting after hours, there are egregious violations where it's, you know, 2 hours after sunset and you can barely see anything. So maybe it isn't an issue, but I'm, you know, ordinarily I would defer to the enforcement staff on something like this, but I understand Commissioner Kellogg's point as well.
Well, Mike, I understand what you're saying, but I really don't believe where there's a club next to a game bird club that there would really be a problem, because those people are the people that obey the laws. It's the unattached hunter that might be hunting out next to the club that would be a problem for enforcement, and I don't think that you're going to have a lot of that on the edge of those game bird clubs.
Commissioners, any feedback on the youth turkey issue?
Too many numbers. Thank you. Moving on to item 18, receipt of public recommendations and request for authorization to publish notice of intent to consider amendments of the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 2007-2008. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for August 10th, 2007 in Santa Barbara. Dan Perigary. Is Dan here? There he is. Easy Rider came up on his motorcycle this morning, so he might be a little muddleheaded. I'm not sure, but and cold. Have you thawed out yet?
Oh, no. It was wonderful.
All right.
Thank you. Good morning, Vice President Gustafson, Commission, and staff. Dan Perigary, Wildlife Branch. I have just a very few quick slides on our recommendations relative to Section 502. So, Steve, are we ready? So these are the department's limited recommendations in your initial statement of reasons. We have a minor name change. This was brought up by the public last year, very late in the process, so we decided to pick it up this year. It's just a clarification. We have two increases in goose daily bag limits. They kind of vary by zone. These two proposals require changes in the federal frameworks, so those need flyway approval as well as the Fish and Wildlife Service approval. And then, as we standardly do at this time of the year, we provide you a range of season dates and bag limits because we don't know what the federal frameworks are going to be for the general duck seasons. These goose liberalizations that we're proposing are targeted primarily at white-fronted geese and white geese. Here you see our fall index for white-fronted geese back to at least recorded history highs. They're quite a bit above their flyway up objective level of 300,000, so they're doing quite well. Similarly, our white goose index, which is made up of both Rosses and lesser snow geese, is also well above the long-term average and increasing. So for a number of conservation reasons, we are proposing a little more take on these species. We can get into those if you'd like. Similarly, the third proposal we have is for an increase in the daily bag limit of Aleutian Canada geese. These birds were once endangered. Their flyway population level, objective level, is 60,000, and they're now currently rattling around twice that, at about 120,000. They're causing some significant depredation issues on the northwest coast in their spring. Last year, we recommended and you adopted a late season, the first time we've utilized that management tool here in California. It was very successful and very popular with both the landowners and the hunting public. So given that we're way over our objective on these guys, we're trying to take a few more consistent with the flyway management plan. I thought I'd take a brief second to give you a hint of what may be coming from the prairies of Canada. This is precipitation totals from April and May. Blue and green are really good colors. Compared to last year, this is a little misleading because it's the period April through August, so it picked up the June-July period. But nevertheless, conditions appear to be very good so far in Prairie Canada, and we're looking forward to maybe a decent fall flight of ducks from that neck of the woods. We just completed our local breeding duck survey this year, and here's our results. For mallards, I didn't graph up the total duck index, but our breeding population estimate declined 3% from last year. Statistically, however, it's insignificant from both the previous year or the long-term average. So at least local mallards, our most abundant nesting duck in California, are just kind of floating along about average. I'd also summarize briefly for you what's coming up. As you know, this migratory bird stuff is intertwined very tightly with the Fish and Wildlife Service. We expect to see their breeding, preliminary breeding population stuff later this month. Similarly, their harvest estimates from last year later this month. Late in the month will be the June Service Regulations Committee meeting. There's quite a bit of interest going on around the country relative to scop bag limits. If the service's current proposal stays through and the scop population declines a little bit, we may be looking at some significant reductions in season and bag length, which may complicate our regulations quite a bit, but there's still much to come on that. Of course, you know you have another discussion meeting in mid-July. In late July, the Flyway Council will meet, and on August 1st and 2nd, I believe, the SRC will set the final frameworks, and we'll be scrambling to get you a specific set of recommendations in time for your adoption hearing on August 10th. These slides are for your next agenda item, so if there's any questions relative to migratory birds, I'm at your disposal.
Thank you. Wow, now I'm loud. Commissioners?
I must admit I haven't paid attention to waterfowl populations in a few years, but I find that recovery, the population recovery is remarkable.
On Aleutians?
On many of the geese and so forth. What accounts for that? Are we dealing with much better breeding success and habitat improvement in the north?
Or? Well, there's with goose populations, of course, you got a mixed bag. White fronts, the decline was due to overharvest. It was a mix of subsistence harvest in Alaska as well as fall harvest in the lower 48, which is primarily California. We dealt with that through about a 20-year restrictive period, and we paid our dues. We've been cautiously liberalizing as we went over our population objective, and now we're getting to the point with white fronts. Late spring, they're causing problems for Oregon farmers in the Klamath Basin. Whether they're running out of resources here, whether it's whatever, but they're leaving the Central Valley in earlier and in bigger numbers, and so there's some conservation issues there. They're well over our flyway objective, which when we set that at 300,000 when there was about 80,000 of them, and folks thought, nah, no way you're going to get that. White geese in the eastern part of the continent are doing very, very, very well, and to the point where they're damaging the tundra ecosystem. The service has done some things. They're starting to increase now. We've held off on increasing those because our white goose flock is a mix of both Ross geese and two populations of lesser snow geese, and the Wrangell Island bunch of those has finally reached their population objective.
Ryan, I think we should transfer this gentleman to the Endangered Species Branch, see if we can, you know, have similar recoveries there.
Mike, I think a lot of what some people miss a point on is that California Waterfowl Ducks Unlimited and duck clubs in general have done a tremendous effort, not only with the mallard, but the wood duck and the other species. And those efforts over the years, and including working with rice farmers, and I mean, they're going to the trouble of picking up eggs out of nests and taking them to incubators and making sure that all these things happen. And it took a few years for all that to prolificize itself, and I think that's what we're seeing the results of, is a lot of the work that hunters themselves have added to bringing back the decline in the duck population in the state.
Well, it's a terrific track record of recovery, and I remember the wars we had in Alaska over subsistence the debate over who should get what, but it looks like whatever we've done is working.
Well, I did have the pleasure of serving on the Aleutian Goose Recovery Team. It's been a major part of my career, actually. But frankly, we always say we really can't take too much credit for that. The birds have done all the work. That was a response primarily to predator control activities as well as harvest restrictions for those guys. Their nesting grounds are in good shape.
Well, if there's more, Deanna will be here. We have four speaker cards. And I also wanted to announce before we get to the speakers two quick things. One, Steve Matthew, our AGP video guru, asked me to mention that he forgot to mention earlier. There's a all-new audio-only live stream button on calspan.org. For anyone who's watching right now, if you've got a 56K system or a weaker internet connection, you can hit that live audio-only, and you won't get to see our faces, but you'll get to hear all the action. So the other thing I want to remind everyone, yesterday morning, first thing, the commission added an agenda item under a 48-hour notice procedure. It's 19A. So for those of you who weren't here yesterday, 19A is reconsideration of the department recommendation for species to be depicted on the California duck stamp for 2007 through 2011. So if anyone wants to speak on that item, please turn in a card. So now we'll move to public speakers on item 18. 3 minutes apiece, starting with Steve Harding, followed by Bill Gaines, followed by Walt Manzel, and possibly Jim Waters.
Good morning. Steve Harding, Gray Eagle Store, Plumas County. I don't think I should have been in this category, but I'm going to speak anyway. I think I feel like a pair of brown shoes, an old George Gobel line, in a room full of tuxedos. But I am a simple store owner who's been selling fishing licenses for 35 years in Plumas County. And the new computerized license system, I'm sure, makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. But you're losing that one-on-one contact that I have been dealing with for many, many years. My question is simple. Are you going to continue the COD license purchase system where I write a check for the licenses that I sell at my front counter because I don't have 27 inches of counter space for the new computer? My building is old. I don't want to put in a dedicated phone line. I want to just continue to serve the public the way I have with a COD purchase of licenses. Are you going to continue that after August of this year?
Sankey, do you want to respond? First off, I don't want to see you change that store because that's one of my favorite stops on the way up there, and it is a great market. So I go every year in October and stock up at your store. So
thank you.
Don't want to see you change that wood counter.
I'd like to acknowledge also you were correct that you are not speaking under the correct agenda item, but this is an important issue, and you know we'll give you a couple of minutes here in the department. This was discussed yesterday, but I think the department can give you a quick answer on your concern here.
As the commissioners will remember, this has been an Achilles heel or major issue in our adjustment to an electronic process or system. The plan is not to continue a paper separate system. It will not work with ALDS. We are looking at other systems that would be compatible with the ultimate ALDS system, but the traditional COD paper system will not persist once it's fully implemented. And we are working with the license agents such as his. We are trying to promote that, you know, local tackle shop venue. We feel that's very important, and we're trying to figure out some alternatives, but it will not be that system as it's currently being designed.
Well,
Commissioner Hanna, did you have a comment?
Just a question. Sankey, this was brought up yesterday relative to a boat on Lake Tahoe. How different is this from the boat on Lake Tahoe?
Similar kind of system. These are two systems where you have typically small, unique, short turnaround license sales. In this case, the gentleman and the boat have a similarity in that they're not. It would be difficult to go internet. Either it's a phone line or the boat isn't set up, obviously, for a line, although wireless might be an option. As with the gentleman yesterday at Lake Tahoe, there is a process by we're looking at where the, in that case, the skipper could buy over the ALDS system some pre-licenses that he can resell. They may have an expiration date, so there's not a lot of these sitting out there because we have some fraud issues. So we would have to look at some similar system for a vendor like this who cannot deal with an internet directly or have it on a counter space. I totally understand the issue of counter space. So we're looking at options that could be compatible, and the encouraging thing is this technology is evolving so rapidly that we may have a very simple solution very soon. As you know, we're designing, putting the final design parts into it with a trial rollout next summer, as I mentioned yesterday during the testimony.
And I agree we should have that. However, as progress has moved us forward, I mean, even our kids anymore don't know how to work a slide rule. Nobody needs any more pencil and paper. We lose contact with our constituents, our people, the people that come into your store, and I know your store well also. It would be a shame to lose that. So if the answer remains the same for him as it does for the guy on the boat yesterday, I'm sure he's going to be satisfied with that.
We will certainly do our best to accommodate, but we're going to have to, the best we can do is meet halfway. We cannot maintain the current system.
Right.
That does not work.
Mr. Harding, I want to thank you for driving down this morning, and you may or may not be aware that we have a one-year delay in this, and I think the commission would love to see the department work on these individual situations to see how we can adjust both to some comments we heard yesterday as well as your comments. So
I must have missed that news about a yesterday meeting. I only got this in the mail, and it was today.
But thank you again for driving down this morning. I hope you had a beautiful drive.
I wish the commission luck. You're losing contact with the one-on-one.
Right. Well, we're going to urge the department to see what we can do to solve some of these issues.
Okay.
Mike wants to.
Yeah, I was going to say this yesterday, but it's come up again now. I hunt a lot in Oregon and fish in Oregon and other states that have implemented these systems. There's no loss of personal contact in these systems with hunters and fishermen. You still have to go to a license agent to get your license. They just go to a terminal instead of using pen and paper. And I don't know, Sankey, if you guys have looked at how they made those transitions in states like Oregon, where it's all computerized already, but there must be lots of lessons learned from those states. I can buy my hunting license for South Dakota before I leave on my trip on the internet. I find that very convenient. Yes, it does. You know, there isn't that personal contact with a license agent, but it is, you know, we're increasingly going to an internet world. I don't want to see this become a big issue for local license agents, but I'm sure there's a way to resolve this, and I think you guys are working on that.
Yeah, there are, in fact, many lessons learned and examples throughout the country where they've already done this, and what it boils down to is individual businessmen and women having to make a decision on whether they want to be part of this or give it up. But you'd be amazed, for example, in Idaho, some of the remote little tackle shops that are fully wired to the internet and are selling licenses online. And that's really what it boils down to is we are working with the individual license agents, helping them figure out how to make that decision. But it's going to be their decision whether they can accommodate and be part of this system. And we're doing everything we can not to lose any of them. But it is going to change. It's not going to stay the same.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Next speaker, Bill Gaines, followed by Walt Manzel.
Vice President Gustafson, members of the commission, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines, president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'm here today to offer some preliminary recommendations from two different regional groups in regards to the 2007-2008 waterfowl seasons and bag limits. I know it's early. I know we're still waiting for some of the bird numbers to come in. We're still waiting for the federal framework. to be taken action on. We're also still waiting for Flyways, of course, to make their recommendations as well, but I would like to offer these preliminary recommendations. First one is from the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association. The current Tulare Basin historically offered the largest contiguous wetland in the state of California, over 80 miles from end to end, 500,000 acres of wetland habitat in a flood year. Today, the entire hydrology has been changed. We're looking at about 15,000 acres of managed wetlands down there, and that includes the Kern National Wildlife Refuge. The remainder of it, of course, is provided by private clubs. Incentives for those clubs to flood up in an area where water is scarce and very expensive are incredibly important if we're going to continue to maintain that habitat down there. Last year, the Fish and Game Commission offered the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association a slightly earlier opener than the general balance of the state zone. That provided the incentive for those landowners to provide some early water down there, which is important for the early arriving northern pintail, which used the current Tulare Basin as a very important staging and wintering area. The Tulare Basin Wetlands Association would like to offer the preliminary recommendation to the Commission today to consider once again this year a somewhat earlier opener down in the Tulare Basin to provide that incentive to the private landowners to flood up. I will tell you that the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association will continue to work very, very closely with the California Waterfowl Association Regulations and Traditions Committee, the Department of Fish and Game, and the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance to try to reach full consensus on this issue prior to bringing it forward at the August 10th hearing, where the actual waterfowl seasons will be adopted. Secondly, on behalf of the Black Brant Group, which is a group of waterfowl and brant hunters in Morro Bay, they're asking the commission this year to once again consider a split zone, if you will, offering Northern California, those that shoot brant up in Humboldt Bay, a season that could possibly be different than the Morro Bay season. They're also asking for a 30-day season starting the second Saturday of November, which is November 10th, running straight for 30 days. Again, that's a preliminary recommendation, pending federal framework and flyway recommendations. And they, too, will work closely with the California Waterfowl Association Regulations and Traditions Committee and the Department of Fish and Game to reach consensus prior to the August 10th adoption hearing. Lastly, I'd like to touch base quickly on the SHARE program, the Shared Habitat Alliance for Recreational Enhancement Program. That program was created by CWA-sponsored legislation back in 2003. California Outdoor Heritage Alliance was pleased to take the lead in offering the pilot program this year. We had several hunts in the Central Valley, but what I want to talk about today is the North Coast. Dan Perigary just mentioned a few minutes ago the Aleutian Canada Goose late-season depredation hunt that took place up on the North Coast. That's on private lands only. The public lands are closed during that late season, the intent being to move the birds off of the private ground where they're doing such significant damage to the ranchers up there, put them on the public grounds that are there specifically for those birds. Last year, the SHARE program offered over 200 hunter days up there. We had over 500 applicants to hunt the SHARE program up on the North Coast. And I have to tell you, the users were very, very pleased. We received several letters and phone calls in regards to their happiness with quality hunts up there on the North Coast for Aleutians. And perhaps even more importantly, the landowners were very pleased. We had 13 landowners enrolled in the SHARE program on the North Coast last year. We've already been approached by 20 urging us to run the program again this coming year. And we also have today, and I'll offer these to the commission when I'm done here, I have a letter thanking for the SHARE program and saying what a success it was from the Del Norte County Farm Bureau. I have another letter, similar letter, from the Humboldt County Farm Bureau, which is additional testimony to the success up there from a landowner perspective. And if anybody's got any questions regarding the SHARE program, I'd be happy to answer them now. California Outdoor Heritage Alliance looks forward to working closely not only with the commission on offering similar late-season hunts this coming year, but also working with the Department of Fish and Game to implement the SHARE program.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. Walt Manziel.
We just want to express our thanks to the department and all the people involved in the recovery of so much of our waterfowl populations. I know they've worked very hard on it. We won't make specific requests at this time, but we will reserve that for the next meeting. And after we talk with Mr. Gaines, we may be able to support some of the things that he's proposed here if the populations and the frameworks allow that.
Thank you, Walt.
That concludes our public speakers for this morning on item 18.
Commissioners, any direction or questions, comments?
I would only just encourage Mr. Gaines and Mandel to continue working in the effort you're working in, and thank you for working in harmony with the department and with us.
Thank you. Director Broderick.
Vice President, Commissioners, thank you. Just a note of recognition for Dan Perigary. It was mentioned earlier that the recovery of these geese species, and the Aleutian goose in particular. I had the pleasure of being the junior and senior consultant of the Pacific Flyway Council, representing the Pacific Flyway Council at the Migratory Bird Treaty Office, when we talked about taking something from an endangered status or a threatened status to recovered, and then a couple years of delay working on really good numbers to actually get to a harvest management plan for the Aleutians. Had the pleasure of being able to make the recommendation for a bag limit on Aleutian geese, which has now gone from 2 to 6 in recommendations. Dan represents one of about less than a dozen cadre of waterfowl biologists from Alaska all the way down through the central into Central California that worked a lot of time and a lot of years and brought a lot of science and a lot of management and personnel interpersonal skills to a biological debate that involved taking care of the geese literally from cradle to grave, and grave did not necessarily mean our wildlife hunting areas, you know, for a long period of time. So Dan needs to be recognized. The amount of interaction with the native tribes of Alaska, the local governments in Alaska, Oregon, Washington, California, it's just amazing the influence that folks like Dan and a very small cadre of other waterfowl biologists have had in having a very deliberate and a very credible pathway for recovery, and then managed to get incredible support from the states, the Native American tribes, and the hunting public to allow that recovery. But the East Coast was stunned. You know, they have a little thing called a black duck, and here we talk about the Aleutian goose, and we tell them we want to hunt them, and they think that doesn't make any sense. And then we want to double the bag limit, and then we want to double it again. So we should celebrate that success story. I think Dan's done too good of a job. Now we're twice at the population objective, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, on Aleutian geese. So thank you.
Okay, commissioners, we do need a motion on this item.
If you'd like, I can give a suggested motion.
Okay.
Fish and Game Commission hereby authorizes its staff to publish notice of commission intent to amend the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 2007 to 2008.
So moved.
Second.
Any comments or questions? Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Moving on to item number 19, consideration of 2007-2008 California Duck Stamp and Ducks Unlimited Marsh projects. And we're also combining this with item 19A, reconsideration of department recommendation for species to be depicted on the California Duck Stamp for 2007-2001.
Mr. Carlson, and we had a quick, if we could take just a 5-minute break, and we'll come right back to this item. Thank you.
Thank you.
John, for your assistance there. Okay, we'll come back to order and resume. I think we're on item 19A.
Actually, item 19.
19, I'm sorry.
Consideration of 2007-2008 California Duck Stamp and Ducks Unlimited Marsh projects. And Dan, yesterday I kind of made a recommendation that this would be an acronym-free zone. And I can tell you right now, off the top of my head, don't know what MARSH you have a period here. Could you explain that? There were some acronyms this morning, and I let people slide. But
well, you can't hold me to rules I wasn't aware of, but now that I am.
Well, I'm going easy on you for now. So
you weren't easy on me when I worked directly for you. I don't know why that should change.
Oh, well.
In response to John's question, that is a Ducks Unlimited program matching aid to restore state habitats. And we'll talk about the details in a second, unless you're ready.
We're ready for your presentation.
Okay, right. Thank you. Thanks, Steve.
Are we Dan Perry. Here to go?
I'm not going to go through all that list of projects and stuff, but because we have two new commissioners that haven't had the pleasure of looking at this process, I thought I'd give you a little bit of background on the California State Duck Stamp Program. We were the first state in the nation to actually issue a state duck stamp in 1971. It was promoted to the legislature by the California Duck Hunters Association, kind of precursor to CWA. It was a hunter-based approach to basically said, we'll throw an extra buck in the pot if you'll do more good stuff for ducks than you're already doing. So we started a trend in this state that most of the other states soon followed. So I think we should be proud of it and everything we've accomplished with it. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background about the process and how we select projects that's in that recommendation that's in front of you. This was enacted in the Fish and Game Code, and there's several major requirements here that, you know, the hunters are required to have one to go hunting. The funds go into a dedicated account. The law stipulates that $2.25 from each stamp shall be spent in Canada. The law stipulates the department reviews the feasibility of all these projects and makes recommendations to you, and that you have the actual authority to approve the projects and the expenditure of those funds. Our process for getting these in front of you, about December or so of each year, somewhere around Christmas, we solicit proposals throughout California, land management agencies, private NGOs, anybody with an interest that might do good stuff for ducks. We review those things with an advisory committee that includes the California Waterfowl Association, Ducks Unlimited, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. These folks provide us with a real technical look at these projects, they review and just sort of rank them for us, and they consider things like cost, efficiency, distribution of projects. We try to spread the projects around the state because the money comes from around the state. Where projects of a particular area has had a bunch of projects recently, even though they got a good one this year, they might have to wait a year or two. And then finally, after that advisory committee provides some input, we sit down with representatives from the department from throughout the region, and what comes out of that is that list that's in front of you today. Duck stamp sales are in a slow and long-term steady decline. We started the first year with selling about 170,000 of them. Probably some chunk of that went to the stamp collecting community. And we currently sell about 70,000-75,000 stamps a year. Originally, the stamp was a buck, and it went to $5 and $7.50 and $10, and now it's where it's at now. I can't even tell you what the projected cost will be this year, to be honest with you. But we're taking in about $1 million a year from the sales of stamps currently. I'm sorry?
No, don't worry. But, Dan, you don't need to respond to the audience. Thanks.
I'm sorry. I'm a public servant. I'm just used to responding. In our process, and I've got a definition slide that's a little further back in this, but you can see from this graphic that primarily we recommend to you habitat projects. But the Act also allows resource assessments and research relative to waterfowl. And we try to keep – there's no set rule in this. We take it on a year-to-year basis, but our emphasis has always been habitat work with it. And that habitat work is really really routine, but it's not cheap anymore as we re-level land, put in water control structures, transplant tules, build and install pumps and water conveyance structures. These things are all getting more and more expensive all the time, and, of course, they're necessary for decent waterfowl habitat. I want to talk specifically for a second about the money that goes to Canada. As I said earlier, $2 from each stamp. Purposes of the North American Waterfowl Plan, and the money has to be matched. And this is a really critical thing because our funds that we send forward end up getting matched sometimes two or three times. The department also sends money up there via our comprehensive wetland program that Dean Quasney runs, and every year or two, one of us will go up there and inspect the projects. We've spent a fair bit of the public's money in Canada doing good things for ducks. Dean had the pleasure of going last month, and I showed you that slide earlier about the water conditions in Canada. This is a slide that Dean took on May 30th, so right in southern Alberta. So they had a bit of snow and a bit of water. Traditionally, the duck stamp funded projects and a lot of projects that were completed in Canada were water things, build dams, water control pumps and stuff like that. And we've gotten away from that a little bit, and you can see in that proposal from Ducks Unlimited this year that we're recommending that we're gone to more and I'm sorry about the slide. I'll explain it in a second. More holistic things which approach more than just the water, but the grazing systems that provide the nesting habitat that's really important to things like pintail. And my wisecrack about this sign is that we just took it yesterday after a Southern California team took the Stanley Cup, and the Canadians weren't too happy about it. It doesn't show up very well in this slide, but you'll see the emblem there for the North American Waterfowl Management Plan in blue, as well as Ducks Unlimited and the Alberta Prairie Wildlife folks. So, again, these are combined, cooperative, collaborative projects in which they're trying to affect literally landscapes, thousands and thousands of acres. I tried to figure out what that was, and there's a lot of big pellets in it. I don't know what that was. The second thing that I wanted to highlight for you is a subsequent section that defines the projects. And we've talked about the preserve, restore, enhance, and the habitat ones. But the second part is the waterfowl resource assessment and research projects. In your package, you'll see things for what we call resource assessment, the operational duck banding that we do with California Waterfowl Association. We've recommended and you funded projects on molting mallard research. One that I really want to call attention to, John Eadie's given you presentations before, but again, this commission went out front on this Raveling Endowed Professorship. We used, over the course of 3 years, $300,000 of state duck stamp money, which was used as a match for private donations to make that endowed professorship, I believe, well over $1 million. And the result of that has been a lot of things that, if we'd have just bought these on an individual basis, that money's still there. They're running off the interest on that interest-bearing account. And some of the projects that have been completed here in California with that, this seed resource availability thing that's having implications in our joint venture management planning. A student just finished a mallard nesting ecology study, and I'm real proud to say that we hired this young man, a student of John Eadie's, Sean Oldenberger. He's a real asset to us now. We're very, very glad to have him. There's been brood survival studies, and there's currently a study ongoing on body condition relative to landscape habitat changes. And then just quickly, I'd remind you of a project that you funded that the department did cooperatively with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. This is what we call a PTT, sorry, John, a platform transmitting terminal. It's a satellite transmitter. These little jewels are about $3,000 a piece. You paid for some. Along with Alaska, they were surgically implanted by a veterinarian. These are very hard to see, but what's neat about this is the track of a bird that we marked in January 05 on the Delavan National Wildlife Refuge. It's made two complete migrations, and up there in that big clump of location dates up in the Upper Cook Inlet near Anchorage is a last record of June 5th. So you can get virtually real-time data from these guys. We've learned some things about their molt migration, their distribution, their timing of migration. This has just been very fascinating stuff that we hope will help us manage tule geese, which may be the rarest goose in North America, winters primarily in the Central Valley of California. We've got quite restrictive regulations in place to protect those. And here's a close-up of a tule goose and one of the VHF radio transmitters that we're putting on for population estimation stuff, and that's also a project that's in front of you today. So that's just a brief summary of our process for getting around to that list of projects that's in front of you today. That's all I had there.
Great, Dan. Thank you very much. Commissioners, any questions?
Are you sure that goose isn't rare because nobody wants to breed with it when it looks like that?
They're not usually very happy after we've had our way with them, I got to tell you. But there's been lots of studies on the evaluation of color marking geese, and for the most part, especially birds that avoid ice conditions, it's not a problem. They reproduce. I've got pictures of birds we've marked on a nest.
The satellite tagging really has revolutionized our knowledge of movements. We've done the same thing with tunas. We've tracked, you know, oceanic migrations. You don't have to get that tag back in order to track it. It transmits to the satellite.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. It's a problem for birds because, you know, we try to put things in them that are less than 2 or 3% of their body weight. And so to get a thing on them or in them that we believe won't affect their survival and flight capabilities, you don't get a lot of life out of them. You know, a couple years and their batteries go dead.
Okay. Does staff have a recommendation on this?
Thanks, Dan. We have a suggested motion. Fish and Game Commission hereby approves the department's recommendations for duck stamp expenditures and DU marsh projects for 2007-2008, subject to terms and conditions established by the department.
So moved.
Do I have a second? Okay. Dan, did you have...
I'm sorry I lied to you already today. I didn't get into that marsh project. What Ducks Unlimited does for us is provide a set of matching dollars that on projects that we review and want to work with, Ducks Unlimited will provide money. So when you look through those list of projects, you'll see some that have DU money attached to them. So it makes our duck stamp money go a little bit further, and that's what the matching aid is about. So I'm sorry I didn't explain it.
Thank you, Dan. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you. Now this takes us to 19A. Now, I don't know if I mentioned over the microphone, we had no public speaker cards for that, and we have none for 19A at this point. 19A is reconsideration of the department recommendation for species to be depicted on the California duck stamp for 2007 through 2011. I think Dan, were you? You have a little presentation on someone. I need someone from the department to kind of explain the situation that there were no artists this year that put in for this, so we're kind of in a backed into a corner right now.
I apologize for the confusion on that. Ryan Broderick, Director of Department of Fish and Game. The issue with our duck stamp, as you know, we've over the last 3 years we've gone through a kind of a re-engineering of the process, the protocols, as well as worked very diligently to make sure that there was additional income through that process that came to the department. During that review, we changed the request for proposals guidelines. This last year, I think at least the feedback I've got, since this is the 100th year commemoration of our hunting license, we went kind of to a retro look. Those of you that have got your license will see a depiction of artwork around the perimeter, and the feedback to date has been very positive. Last year, Sherry Russell-Moline won the duck stamp at the state level. She also won it at the federal level. We did not have a response to the RFP this year. Unusual, and I think the key before the commission and the request is you had identified a sequence. You set the species in which are going to be considered. It was going to be the redhead duck, if I'm not mistaken, this year. We have and own that 1971 print that you saw that teed up the duck stamp projects. We would like your consideration and approval of allowing us to use the pintail instead of the redhead as the image, and then use that 1971 print as our duck stamp this year. It will be a very nice complement to the license that commemorates the 100th year, and that's the request before you.
Could we get that back up on the screen? And just to clarify what Ryan was saying on the species, just to remind the commissioners, last year, the commission took action to designate a species for each year through 2011. Ryan was right. This year's the redhead. 08 was the northern shoveler. 09 was the Barrow's goldeneye. 2010 was the northern pintail. And 2011, the Aleutian goose.
That's the 2001st duck stamp there.
Commissioner Kellogg, that's the first year. That's the dollar. That stamp that says a dollar on it. So that's
it's hard to see.
It was a good deal then too.
I've already purchased my hunting license, and I think that you guys did a great job of designing the Centennial hunting license, and this would be a good fit to go along with it. But my question is. Since I've been on this commission, it's been a lot of fun every year to look at the different artists' presentations of their idea of what the duck stamp should be every year. And I'd just like to ask the department what they attribute the fact that we didn't get any submissions at all this year, and how do we get back to that process, and in the future, and where the commission can move back into where we get to make the decision on what's going to, the duck stamp's going to be in the future, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Commissioner Kellogg, it's a good question, and I think you, amongst a variety of others, have participated in that, in that artwork. I think in the transition we went through, number one, in the request for proposals, we probably weren't competitive. Let's be candid in terms of what we were expecting for revenues back to the department. We have typically had quite a few. Well, actually, we haven't. You know, that we had a series there for a number of years where we had the same artist, and then we changed the competition and we had, I think, a total of two artists. So we've never had a lot of competitors. It's a lot of work, and it's not so much the artwork; it's the marketing and the distribution that you have to be engaged in. So, Bob Steiner, Rich Rodaganda, Melissa. Sherry Russell Moline. Those are the three over what I think, Dan, the last 12, 14 years that have actually been the artists. So we're going to have to relook. I'd look forward to having the commission's kind of participation in how we make this both an art competition and a financial complement to the duck stamp program. But when we came back, we did not expect to have no submissions. We thought for sure we would have at least the three artists that had been successful try to stay back in the system. So we're going to review the request for proposals. We'll look at how we can construct this to maintain the financial integrity while at the same time make it an art contest. I think fortunately, since we own the copyright on this and the 100-year centennial license, this is an appropriate, you know, match for this year, but we need to reconsider that. The other issue is we've had a series of additions, and those additions have been kind of rationalized over the years, but it also is important that we kind of go back and talk about what type of additions, whether it be, you know, general edition, governor's remark, and I think we'll have to kind of put our thinking caps back on. We really wanted to make this a competition. We did. I think, generated significantly more income as a percentage of revenue, total revenues back to the department. But we obviously overstated our ability to make it profitable for some artists, or we would have had a lot more submissions.
Go ahead,
May
Commissioner Hanna.
So, Ryan, the key is the financial aspect of it. The artists aren't making any money on this. And in addition, that's a two-part question, and they're required to do the marketing for it. Is that correct?
They're required to do the market. In the request for proposals, their ability to market the product, your product, our product, is critical. And then the percent that comes back to the department. You know, I'm not going to say the artists aren't making any money on this, okay, because that's, you know, we haven't run a check on it. But usually, I just don't know the individual circumstance, but it is a lot of work. We ask in the marketing proposal, many of those artists show up, and in getting that request for proposals, they agree to part of the competitive index. Now, this is part of their proposal, is they're going to direct market that product at sports shows and decoy shows and other events. And it is a when you win the state duck stamp, and you've done it with a request for proposal that includes your direct marketing to a variety of venues, which makes them competitive and then selected, it is a significant commitment of time. I mean, your state duck stamp is your product for that year.
Sure. Almost unrelated question. I heard a rumor that Upland Game Bird stamps are going to be discontinued. Is there any truth to that?
The
Upland Game Bird.
That we're getting the same problem?
Yes, that it will be discontinued.
That's a rumor I didn't start, so.
Okay.
Anyone,
that's good.
I hope not.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, just to follow up on Judd's comments, just this last weekend I went to a CWA youth fair at Grizzly Island where they had booths, and one of the previously mentioned artists was there with a booth, and it really hard for me to think that those artists don't make a ton of money with that duck stamp, with the prices that he had on those, that he had at that booth. But with that being said, if the commission's willing, I'd like to make a motion that we rescind our previous action requesting the redhead duck be the stamp for this year, and accept the original duck stamp to go along with the centennial hunting license this year.
Could I ask?
Do I have a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now let's go to discussion.
I just was wondering for a little clarification. If at the pleasure of the commission, we could flip flop these and then place the redhead back to switch it with the pintail. So the pintail was 2010. Flip flop that to this year and then put the redhead in the 2010 slot. If you want to keep redhead on the list.
I'm fine with that. That's okay. It's okay.
Okay.
That'll be the motion then, that we switch this year's duck stamp with the 2010 choice and go with the original duck stamp to be mated with the centennial hunting license.
Okay.
And I can second that.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Yeah, just a thought comes to mind on any of these where I think artists aren't well known as business people. And Sherry Russell probably is, because she's just been fantastic over the years, and Robert Steiner as well. But to get more people into the mix, to get more bids on this, if you will, probably is going to involve some bending on our part to assist with some marketing efforts, something that will make that work a little better for them. My only thought on it.
Commissioner Hannity, you raise a good point in the distribution. Cheryl Smolina is exceptional at it, tireless in the marketing as well. But that is not the common capacity. Bob Steiner, obviously Robert Steiner, had a significant organization behind him and capacity there. We do not preclude in the RFP kind of a proposal that has the marketing a component that is independent of the artist. They just have to be integrated under some form of contractual agreement, so we know they have the capacity to get it out. But I think it's time to get some of the artists in that have done this across the nation. You know, this has become a huge industry, and kind of do a brainstorming session with the best and most successful and see what their suggestions are.
Ryan, do you know what the contractual what the contract looks like for the federal duck stamp? Because they have dozens of applicants for that one. I don't know how it might differ from ours.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Commissioner Sutton. And we're going to pull that, because I think the comment I got from several artists is we'd like to see you evolve to the more of the federal RFP or contract approach. And obviously that's extremely popular. Their youth competition as well as their adult competition is exceptional. So we're going to, this was first to take a system that was on autopilot and make it a good return, capitalize on the governor's trademark signature. We got three more years. I want to really take advantage of that in the governor's edition.
Great. Thank you. Well, we have a motion and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you. That moves us to item number 20. Status update on draft environmental document, receipt of special report and supplemental information, and receipt of public testimony on proposals to amend sections 353 and 475, Title 14, which is related to methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. Dr. Eric Loft with the Department's Wildlife Branch has a PowerPoint to share, and then we do have public speakers on this item.
Thank you. Commissioners, Eric Loft again with the Wildlife Branch, and I've got a PowerPoint to show. Over the past couple of meetings in particular, that's not mine. That won't go very far. June Commission, there you go. Over the past couple of meetings that the commission has had, we've heard some what I thought was some very good discussion on it relates to this as it relates to this issue. But certainly, one of the things that became noticeable to us was that in California, we needed to develop and articulate better the California perspective. What's going on in California? We've heard quite a bit about Arizona, and certainly for Fish and Wildlife Service and those concerned about the condor as a species in total, you would be concerned about the bird range wide. However, here, for this particular effort, we're trying to focus specifically as it relates to California and the regulation process that you folks are involved in. And so the way we're prefacing this is that the commission and the department regulatory authority is essentially the state of California. And again, much of the public testimony that you've received so far has focused range-wide, and that tends to confuse the specifics of the California situation because we feel that they are different. The Arizona findings are informative and quite instructive in terms of looking at potential risk to condor, but they aren't necessarily representative or comparable to California. So what we'll try to do is I've sort of divided this up into five topics to try to address some of the questions that you folks have had over time and also some of the things that we'd like to try to clarify from the department's perspective to provide more of an overview of condors in California and some of the issues that that we see from the department's perspective and also take advantage of all the available data that we have available to us now. First is just out of the monthly reports that come out, here's the total California condors in the wild trend over the past 10 years. This is effective up through May and includes the unfortunate death of three birds that happened this past May. We have not yet heard, and I don't know if anybody here in the audience knows yet, the reasons for the deaths of those birds, but three condors apparently did die in the month of May this year. And so that actually, in the California number there, it is included in those numbers. And I would guess that there's probably several people in the room who would like to see an endangered species trending that way over a 10-year period, that's a positive thing. So I think overall we're talking about some success at getting some wild birds out there. The other thing that you've heard a lot about is the mean blood levels in condors. And what we have done over the past month is through the UC Davis Wildlife Health Center, we've asked Dr. Chris Kreuter to work and try to obtain as much of the information as available on blood lead levels and samples that have been taken, whether it be at Pinnacles or from the Ventana Group at Big Sur or from Southern California. And Chris and her colleagues at Davis have done a good job of gathering that. We think we've got most of it now as of a week and a half or so ago, at least up through spring of 2007 for the most part. And what we've done is taken it and partitioned it into two particular areas, the Southern California area and then the Northern California area. The Northern California area being the Big Sur Pinnacle group of birds, Southern California being the other ones. And what we have up here at the top, of course, you've heard before repeatedly about the different exposure levels of 0 to 19 being considered background, 20 to 59 micrograms per deciliter of lead in the blood indicates some elevated exposure to lead above what would be normally happening. And then where the concern really kicks in for the bird's health is anything above 60. And the red line across the chart there on the bar here, this is your 60 level where chelation therapy has traditionally been indicated, and if you look at the lead levels from 97 to 2007 for this Southern California group of birds, you find here's where we are. We're consistently in terms of the mean level. It's below the chelation level, but again, it's the folks would tell you also their concern is along this what's going on between 20 and between 60. And whether or not there's some behavioral issues there, you've heard about that, and I think at least a couple of your past meetings, that there are some concerns that the birds may be behaving adversely at those levels of lead in their blood. That previous slide had some of the information that is from this particular study. This is one of the recent studies that you've heard about that we haven't seen much of yet, and we're now starting to see that information and the data. This graph is right out of that paper from Hall et al., lead exposure among reintroduced California condors in Southern California. And what we're looking at here is essentially the seasonality. That was a question, too, that was that you folks had, is that folks had reported that the lead levels were the highest during the deer hunting season. Well, the deer hunting season in this area does start in August, continues into the month of September and into October. And yes, the highest levels of blood were during those 2 months in particular. One of the things the authors acknowledge, however, is their sample wasn't evenly spread across the full year. And what that points to is that we need to have more systematic sampling to really get a better handle in terms of what's going on. But either way, the blood levels were higher during those particular 2 months in the samples collected, but also the average was still well below the chelation level of 60. Here's the that was again for the southern group of birds. Moving north, looking at Big Sur and Pinnacles. This is a combination of data of Big Sur and Pinnacles combined, same kind of thing as a couple of slides ago. And what it suggests is that the mean blood levels in condors for Big Sur and Pinnacle areas are below the chelation thresholds. And those are, of course, plus or minus one standard deviations. And again, here's the 20 level of baseline. And some of this data is presented in the Sorensen and Burnett paper out of 2007. But it also includes further data as well.
Can I ask just a quick question on all three of those charts? How many birds were sampled? I mean, what's your sample size on those?
Yeah, we didn't include the sample size. We've got the standard deviation, but it ranged from 15 to 40.
I think your previous slide might have had some at the tops of those bars, but the one before. Are those sample sizes at the top?
So it's at least. It's tough to tell from this one because that's just done by month. But we have that data too. I mean, we can send you another slide that just shows you those sample sizes. But it varies, of course, from year to year in the samples. But I tend to think that as I remember the numbers, it ranged anywhere from 10 or 15 to up to 40 or 50. So one of the questions that suggestions that we heard also is okay, maybe it would be good to try to illustrate this as, what is the percentage of samples out there that are above this threshold of 20, above the baseline? So that's what this graphic shows, is you've got that baseline or that of 20 micrograms per deciliter that we consider as baseline. How much of the samples collected over this past 10-year period are above that baseline? And so you can see that this is how that trends. You have a couple of high years here, and these are the sample sizes for that. So, up to 60 or 70 in 1998 and 2000. But by and large, most of them are right around in this area here. 20 to 40% of the samples collected are above that baseline level. And so, I took that and I said the next question that I'd have is, how many are above the very higher levels, this level of 60, where you're concerned, again. And so these are the percentages of the overall samples that are above the typical chelation level of 60. And these are the samples, the actual numbers here. So you have, between 0 and I think it was 18% of the samples were above that level and considered clinically affected or were toxic levels. So to summarize that kind of information, what it shows, obviously, is that the condor in the population in the wild has been increasing up to the current year. We know that. The mean lead level, if you're looking at means, it has been below the chelation thresholds for the most part in the recent years. On average, it's been lower in recent years than in the first years of when this data started being collected. And I don't know whether or not that's an artifact of the greater diligence that may be out there, that folks are on top of this faster and keeping the birds in better health. That may very well be the case. What it also suggests is that the effects of the blood levels, that are below the toxic levels, and that's that category between 20 and 60, where folks have talked about the behavior and whether it affects the behavior, and we still aren't really sure how it does. I know there's been some links to human blood lead levels and all that. We're, you know, the Department of Fish and Game isn't qualified to be looking at that stuff and understanding that relationship or whether it's true and how accurate or comparable it is. But I think that isn't a question, is what happens with those birds at those intermediate levels of exposure. And then the last item here is obviously what this also does is if you look at all this data, there's clearly an opportunity at any time for an individual bird to have something go wrong and get a hold of some lead. And that when that happens, those birds tend to spike up, and it seems like, and have really high levels of lead, and that's where you end up getting your mortalities. And so consequently, you know, the point there is that the difference between what an individual happens to an individual and an entire population can be dramatic. It's, you know, my analogy is much like wearing a seatbelt. Most of the time that, you know, I drive to and from where I'm going, and I got home and I didn't need to have my seatbelt. But what, you know, that one time that you do need it, it becomes very important. It's that kind of a level of risk. The second topic that we would look at is a little bit of the history. Condors, of course, evolved scavenging on vast herds of large herbivores in open plain grassland savanna habitats. They didn't, you know, evolve focusing on resident black-tailed deer of the chaparral or oak woodlands of central California. You look at some of the early writings in the 1800s, and there are reports like this: elk 2,000 head and covering the plain for more than a mile in length. Considerations that they were much like the bison, elk and pronghorn throughout much of condor range. You know, and now, of course, those vast herds of large herbivores and the areas that they thrived on in, of native grasslands and provided the biomass that condor relied on are largely gone in California. And now what we're spending a lot of time, I think, talking about here as a main source of food is the black-tailed deer of the chaparral. This is something that I do know something about it a little bit. And black-tail of the chaparral and California mule deer in the Coast Range, they're not populations that gather in large herds. They don't necessarily migrate. They'll move seasonally across slopes. They don't necessarily concentrate on a winter range in large numbers, like perhaps an Arizona Kaibab situation or even a West Slope Sierra Nevada situation. And by and large, these deer do not die in grassland savanna habitats either naturally or by gunshot. But they do tend to die in dense chaparral and woodlands. They'll go in here, and that's where they'll go and die, whether they get shot or they're wounded, lost, and things like that. And I think that's some of the things that we're concerned about from the department's perspective is as a recovery strategy, relying on deer in California as a surrogate for those large grassland, much larger grassland herbivores, there may be some flaws in that from an evolutionary sense. And that's something that we'd ask folks to think about quite a bit. This one needs to be, I don't know if we can lower that a little bit, but one of the things that we've tried to do is also look at what are the observations are out there. We have not found any systematic studies of condor food habits and what they're eating in the wild out there. And you can't read the top piece there, but this is a compilation of observations that we got from Ventana Wildlife Society, from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and from Pinnacles that could document and confirm what it was that they saw the condors feeding on. And the category of observations and the percentages there are at the top. And this, of course, is condor range, and here's the dominant herbivore on annual grassland now in condor range. And what the information, and it is anecdotal still at this time, and we think there needs to be some study on this as well, is that you can look at the top food items: marine mammals, livestock, hunter-killed deer, elk and or pig, some road-killed wildlife at about 8%, other dead deer, etc., wild pig. Other wildlife, I included the squirrel incident last year in 2006 as an example. And coyote. I couldn't find any records of coyote, and we didn't receive any records of coyote. Maybe there's some out there, but we didn't find them. But I think what it points to a little bit is in the case of you are what you eat, that this, you know, if this holds up with some bona fide studies, which I think also need to be done, but they are difficult to do, that it's kind of telling in terms of where we go with Condor and what are the best opportunities for recovery. I apologize for this slide. When I put this out and sent it to some of the guys around the offices, they said, Loft, what are you doing? That's too much. That's a crazy slide. And I said, yeah, that's the point. That was the point, is that there's too much information here. And this gets back to some of the discussion that's been had about how many dead carcasses are out there for condors to feed on. And we've heard numbers like 30,000 or whatever. We don't think there's 30,000 out there. And I highlighted again, I went back just since I did this and highlighted some of the key thoughts that I wanted to make out of this. Right now we estimate that elk and pronghorn, primarily elk, they're less than 1% of the total of what they used to be. Deer and condor range are what they are, so are wild pig, condor range. And then some of the key questions and assumptions that you'd need to ask to be able to come up with how much is really out there. How many carcasses of deer, how many gut piles of deer, and actually how many of those carcasses or gut piles have lead in them? Those are some interesting questions to ask. And it became too complicated. I talked with Sonke a bit about this, and I says, you know, I'm just going to throw my hands up, Sonke. We could build a number down here at the bottom, but it's based on a house of cards, really. You know, what are the lead levels in domestic livestock, marine mammals, and wild ungulates? We don't know. You know, what are the we estimate some things that we know traditionally. We estimate 15% wounding loss in game. We estimate right now, based on some of the surveys, the National Shooting Sports Foundation survey, which was a statewide survey of California, 28% were already non-voluntarily using lead, we assume, because they believed it was already a law. So there's that. One of the most important ones I find here at the bottom is, what are the chances that condor will find the remains before other scavengers? And if it's a deer, the chances are probably slim that they're going to find that carcass. Speaking from experience, deer carcasses in the woods last about 3 days, and then you have a set of legs, and you got a lot of bear scat running around. And you know, you've heard same time that we've been discussing this condor issue, you've been discussing the potential of having more bear hunting because bears are moving more into San Luis Obispo County, things like that. And we have very successful scavengers out there. The coyote is perhaps the most successful one out there. So there's a lot of questions and assumptions here that preclude us from really coming up with a number, I think, of how many carcasses are out there in the field for condors to eat. I think some of the interesting things and opportunities that are out there that folks have pointed out, some recent research has been done, Chamberlain et al., they suggest marine mammals in the coastal strip may be a good opportunity for condor recovery because of the recovery of some of the marine mammals. Sorensen and Burnett's paper, it's one of the recent science papers that's due to be published here real quick. They suggest that the condor feeding along the coast may have lower blood levels, and that may be also a benefit. The other slide here, I stole this off of a UC Santa Cruz slide. It was a sea lion movements. I just thought it was kind of neat, but I think one of the things that we could probably be doing is looking at opportunities to where this might work best for the California condor. The context also, commissioners, is important for accurate information exchange, because I watched and have seen at least two presentations where this picture of a deer and a condor was shown to you, and I went back and I looked and saw that Mike Fry had attributed this to an apparent roadkill. And you know, I don't know if that's true. That's what we have here. But if it is, if that is the true case, and we've seen this in the context of lead and condor and bullets, but it's actually a condor sitting on a roadkill. Even our director had to make comment on this one as a big buck being left there in the field if somebody had shot it. You know, one of the things we're trying to do is be as accurate as possible with the information that we can and is up front. Very much similar to drawing comparisons with Kaibab Plateau. Kind of risky in some cases. The third area, and I've got a couple of maps posted over here on the geographic area. that we're talking about. And I put this slide in here largely because of the handout that we gave you, but I'll move right into it. We have gone in and... Oh, sorry. Yeah. This one? Yeah, the first map that I'll show you, if you make a decision to implement a regulation, the map that I'll show you first is the one that we would propose, and that's based on revision that has been recommended by at least one commissioner here, but also some recommendations by some of the folks that commented on the environmental document. And the next two slides, the next two maps will represent the NAVA bill and what it proposes for particular areas for lead-free. So here's the revised description geographic area that we would throw out as an option and a proposal for you to consider. It's based largely on current range. We're not recommending going into the historical range at this time, because if you were to have a regulation in place and condors started occupying this area, you could always add that. And that's where we're coming from the department's perspective. Here is an outline of what the AB 821, the NAVA bill, would do in that area. That's the geographic area. And then here it is represented by our deer zones. And so it would add, above and beyond what the department has put forward, it would add D7, D8, D9, and D10 deer zones. And our sentiment is that this is a lot of coniferous forest habitat, a lot of deer up in the woods, and potentially impacting 15 to 25,000 deer hunters. Fourth topic that you folks have asked us to come back with, President Rogers made mention of this and requested of Sonke to come back and talk about timelines and things like that. So if you were to adopt a regulation, commissioners, no matter what the year would be, here's how we'd recommend it happen. You make a decision, and then it would take effect on January 1. And because what that would do then, it would give us a staged implementation with initially the things that would be able to be hunted on January 1 are wild pig and coyote, and then not until August would you start to get bear deer hunting and a few elk hunting, and then October some more of the elk hunting. And so by nature that stages in a little bit of the process so not everybody's having to go out and get these lead-free bullets at the same time. Heather, on the timeline, and I labeled this the soonest potential timeline. I'm not actually sure it's the soonest, but I think it's the soonest that we came up with. And one of the things we're going to be looking for from you today is some direction and guidance on the revised proposed project. What that is, recirculation of a draft environmental document. We believe we can get that done, incorporating the new geographic area, incorporating the comments that we've received, and get that completed within a couple of weeks and recirculate it sometime between June 15th and June 22nd. Goes for a 45-day comment period that makes it available and done somewhere around the end of July, beginning of August. Obviously, we would do an amended or a new ISOR. Maybe we'll need some guidance from some of the commission staff and Sonke in terms of what we call that. I'm not sure. But that would need to happen. And then perhaps at your August 10th meeting, we'd be able to bring you a final environmental document. I would suggest that it depends on the extent of the comments that we receive and how quickly we're able to incorporate those comments. And then the commission can certify that final document and perhaps consider adoption of a regulation on August 10th. And I want to make sure that at the end I give both the director and Sonke Mastrip a chance to comment on this potential timeline. Topic five that you talked about quite a bit last time was outreach and some education and incentive ideas. Right now, we've initiated last fall a new study with UC Davis. That's part of why Chris Kreuter out there at UCD is helping collect and starting to compile some information with us. We do want to investigate further the lead and raptors and the condor and other raptors, And we also would recommend refilling a condor biologist position that we have lost last September in the department. Many of you will know Ron Jurek, of course, he tracked and did the condor stuff for the department for well over 20 years, I think, and there's a big gap there for some of us trying to get up to speed at all. We're not real good at it because we're not condor folks, and what Ron's vacancy left a void. Some of the things that we believe we can do through the director's director policy is we can require non-lead ammunition on depredation permits. Some of the other things we'd like to try to do and work on is making our PLM areas in Condor Range use non-lead ammunition, and we think there's ways to do that, maybe provide incentives to those folks, have it be part of their habitat improvement projects. Another item that we would do that we haven't really done at all, other than we issue these kinds of information in our booklets every year, requests to voluntarily get the lead out, but we haven't really done outreach to some of the varmint hunters, asking them to look into using non-lead ammunition. That's something we could also do. And again, increase outreach locally to local county fish and game commissions. We could also present this topic more in our hunter education classes that we do in the department. We need to work on providing some web information like some of the other agencies and organizations are doing, and also work on outreach with constituent groups like hunting and agricultural groups. Ammunition incentive programs was another item, final item that we talked about, and we've kind of scratched our heads about this quite a bit. Not sure how we'd implement this in California, knowing some of the bureaucracy and headaches that we have administratively to do such things. However, the staff that have looked at it think that the model in Arizona is probably a pretty good model, although we are a little concerned that even though they've got what seems to be a good model, they're still having some lead-related condor deaths. And we have not, obviously, within our state, identified a source of funding for this yet. And again, I did mention PLM areas. So for PLM areas, a mechanism for non-lead that could be achieved as part of a program requirements, giving them incentive, maybe increasing the tags that we allocate to those folks, or identification of it as a wildlife benefit or some portion of a ammunition rebate or incentive strategy. And I think that's it. I do have the maps up here, and be glad to take any questions and maybe ask, I don't know, Ryan or Sonke if they wanted to make any comments at this time first. So.
Sure.
Thank you very much. I think the issue before the commission and before the department and the purpose of this was to provide the context that we had talked about in Bodega Bay. The threshold in terms of what we can accomplish administratively as it relates to depredation permits, the PLMs, as you saw on the map, there are some very, very significant acreages that are within condor range that are either PLMs or military reservations. So in the issue of being able to continue to hopefully show that deflection below, to background levels, on lead, we will pursue and report back to the commission what we can do independent of a regulatory package here to establish lead alternatives in those areas. I think it's important to focus on kind of the broad question of the biomass available to condors. They're an incredible bird. We're absolutely committed to their recovery. The landscape that we all know in California that supported them is different. What we did not present today, and I think needs a deliberation with folks that are far more scientifically qualified and perhaps stakeholders that have some of the potential foraging assets out there, both in landscapes and wildlife and or domestic animals, is how do we guide a process that the commission or complement between the commission and the department, a strategy that allows for the condor to continue to expand its range while at the same time have a sufficient biomass to keep them healthy. And that's a combination of both being not exposed to lead, but also having sufficient forage out there on the ground. And can we do something
from within the confines of the commission's regulatory authority and or the department's administrative authority to help with that biomass availability to condors specifically. You asked Vice President Gustafson the question of the sample size. Part of the issue in this was to try to pull all the data, all the samples that had been taken. We didn't selectively go through samples. We tried to have a full reporting of all that was available. But in that process, and part of my frustration, which I will apologize to Deputy Director Maestrup and to Dr. Loft on, was that information was some of it fairly contemporary, but not easy to get access to. I think he referenced that some of the information we just received in the last couple of weeks. And we're trying to give you an honest snapshot of the data that is as contemporary as we can provide. And why I do not want to minimize levels of lead exposure above background, I think that the charts were revealing from the standpoint that we were below, in most cases, the need for chelation. But the chelation bar shouldn't be the objective either. The bar should be keeping it as close to background as possible. It should be keeping it in a range that ensures the continued recovery of the condor. So this is not a chelation argument. That's not our standard. But I think it is important to have the context of what can we do within the confines of our regulatory authority and administrative authority to even reduce that deflection bar closer to background. I would propose that the issues of education and outreach are still significant. The transition into lead-free ammo is going to be one that takes some time. The time frame that you saw was really what we could do on a regulatory timeline with the amendment to the ISOR, and I won't go into more detail there. But I'm starting to ramble, which means I need to shut up. But I hope we captured, and I guess the focus of this is we're trying to bring you the context for conservation and recovery, the governance of conservation and recovery. We're in the governance business, not the advocacy business. And it's important that we strike that target, you know, accurately. And this is a tough issue. I hope with this presentation you can ask questions of Dr. Loft and maybe additional questions that come up. But that was our intent. And, yeah, there was a busy slide there, but this is a complicated and difficult issue. And that real kind of, I won't call it surgical, but the strategic and surgical approach we use on this, the objective is recovery of the condor and having it implementable from the standpoint of us doing it on the, you know, on the landscape. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Director Broderick and Dr. Loft. Commissioners, do you have any questions, or should we proceed with public comment at this point?
Yeah, I have one.
Okay. First, and then...
Eric, quick question for you. Maybe it's a statement. Two Fridays ago, I had lunch with two warden lieutenants at the graduation ceremony, both of whom were from the San Luis Obispo area and were responsible for issuing depredation permits. I don't know the magnitude of the permits that they issue. I imagine it's in the hundreds. They both told me, and I believe it says on the depredation permit, when you exercise or consummate this depredation permit, report back to the department when and where and what. Not one had ever been reported back to these two lieutenants. I find requiring lead ammunition on depredation permits to fall through that same black hole.
Certainly, we do actually in our office collect the depredation permits. They actually, a lot of them do, most of them do, are supposed to end up back in the wildlife branch. And Doug Updike and a seasonal assistant that he has compiles them annually. And we do know that, yeah, there's a lot that we never hear back from. How to fix that, I'm not sure at this point. But certainly if we did specify, and that would be something that we would would probably pull out is for those counties and condor ranges, we'd start looking at them and see, you know, whether or not we've issued, as we're going to perhaps indicate in policy, that, you know, use of non-lead, and then see whether or not they complied with that. But you're right, there's not 100% reporting.
And I would just like to add real quickly, because this is a significant issue you bring forward, whether you do a rulemaking banning lead or we proceed with things like requiring lead-free ammo on depredation permits, which we are phasing in, it's all contingent on effective enforcement and compliance. So for any of this to work, enforcement's going to have to be able to make it stick and work. And, of course, voluntary compliance is the bulk of it. But for that last 10-20%, you're going to have enforcement out there.
Commissioner Sutton, you had a question?
I appreciate your presentation and your comments, Director Broderick. But I'm still a little confused about the department's position on this. Recognizing this is a complex issue, is it the department's position that because the mean levels of lead in condor blood do not exceed the levels at which we would take extraordinary action to chelate them, that we don't need to take action on this issue?
No, if I may respond, that's in fact. The issue of chelation, that shouldn't be the standard. I think that's a standard that people have recognized, where there's intervention, you know, by veterinarians to save the animal. I think that is not the point that I made, that chelation should not be the standard. The issue should be trying to keep it back as close to background as possible. And in doing that, the question is, how effectively can we do that with the tools, you know, before us? And will the program that we can do administratively complement that? Will it continue to get that deflection down based on the California numbers that were provided, where it's above background? Is there real good focused sampling and field work going on so that we can monitor it, you know, effectively? The food habit issues, I think, that were raised, where you saw the the great foraging habitat for condors, but livestock was a predominant source there. I think it's important that we actually promote with our federal partners and NGOs getting some of that analysis done so that we know effectively, based on the forage habits of these condors, where those exposures are occurring. But no, the chelation rate, once the bird has got to chelation, you know, my feeling is it's an exceptional intervention by man or woman, that mankind, that doesn't need to be, that it should not be the standard. The issue is, how do we get it down to where it's at background levels? I don't know that I can, I cannot provide a recommendation to the commission within the scope of our work below background, but that's a little bit bigger venue.
Okay, we'll go to public comment then.
We have 8 public speaker cards, 3 minutes apiece. If you have a card, if someone cedes their time to you, it'll add 1 minute per person to your time. We'll start with, and I'm going to name 3 names at a time. Please line up behind the podium. Ed Worley, followed by Eric Brunneman, followed by Pamela Flick.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Ed Worley. I'm with the National Rifle Association. We've been monitoring this issue quite a lot as you've been going through your process. We have some concerns of where all this process is going. So we're waiting for your reports and waiting for the Fish and Game to come up with their recommendations, and we'll be commenting on those when those come out. So thank you very much, and I'll cede the rest of my time to Tony Canales.
Eric Brunneman, followed by Pamela Flick, followed by Anthony Canales, who will have 1 minute extra on his time.
I should have a PowerPoint. Good morning, Vice President Gustafson, members of the Commission, and department staff. My name is Eric Brunneman. I'm superintendent at Pinnacles National Monument. When I last appeared before you, I was with Chief Biologist Jim Peterson, who presented the science behind analyzing lead in our environment and pathways of lead ingestion by California condors. Today I'm commenting on the other side of the house, efforts to educate the public about California condors, the recovery program, and lead awareness. The Pinnacles program, as you know, was established in 2003. We're one of five released sites. We have 16 free-flying California condors at Pinnacles National Monument. We have, however, had two mortalities in this flock. This occurred last month. At this time, we have no final determination on the cause of death, except to say that it is a forensic issue, and we're very concerned about this at this time. Regarding public education, we hold annual public events at Pinnacles National Monument. Our last condor release in April attracted over 500 visitors. We use the release events as an educational opportunity within the park to our visiting public. But it's not our only opportunity. I'm pleased to announce to your commission today that with our partner, the Institute for Wildlife Studies, we have received a National Fish and Wildlife Foundation grant for public education about lead awareness, totaling $228,000. This will cover a two-year program. Together, working with our other partners, including Department of Defense, Fort Hunter Liggett, United States Fish and Wildlife Service, Ventana Wildlife Society, and the California Department of Fish and Game, we plan to hold at least, there we go, eight community forums in a five-county area surrounding Pinnacles National Monument, including Fort Hunter Liggett and Camp Roberts. We are also seeking, and will be seeking, a coordinator from within the hunting community to help us manage this grant. Forums will be held outside the monument, as they were originally done approximately a year ago. There'll be an opportunity to directly reach ranchers, urban community members, as well as hunters and the hunting community. We want to assess public opinions about the use of non-lead ammunition, and we want to continue supporting other methods of removing lead from the environment, including burying of gut piles and collecting of rodent carcasses. My desire is to repeat the success of the October 2006 shooting event, where we invited hunters to participate in a side-by-side comparison of lead and non-lead ammunition. That event included partners such as the California Rifle and Pistol Association, Bismuth Cartridge Company, Federal Ammunition, and the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute. In summary, it's my commitment that education and engagement with our hunting community must remain a part of any solution to the issues at hand. Thank you very much, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Pamela Flick, followed by Anthony Canales, followed by Gary Langham.
Good morning, Commissioners. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife, California Program Office out of Sacramento. A few days ago, I read a quote in a newspaper article that I think is applicable to the decision before the commission. Paraphrasing, it essentially said that while there are many factors at play in the decline of this species, it was a different species, you must act on the one that is within your control. There's peer-reviewed, published scientific data supporting the assertion that lead ammunition is having a devastating effect on our highly endangered California condors. As I've said before, Defenders feels that it is imperative for the Commission to act on this best available science to reduce the cause of lead poisoning to California condors, which is causing jeopardy to the species and is in direct violation of the Federal Endangered Species Act. The time to act is now. As we heard from Chris Parrish from the Peregrine Fund last month, the Arizona population had a record high in chelation treatments administered in fully 70% of the birds there. And this is while an unprecedented voluntary effort, including a well-received non-lead ammo coupon program, was underway. And I understand, as Dr. Loft mentioned, that Arizona is not California, and they have some different aspects to their California condor population there, but I think some issues are analogous. We don't want to see any more time wasted nor precious funding wasted on implementing a volunteer program in California. We feel that one only needs to look at the Arizona study and the voluntary program to see what success of such measures looks like. Additionally, we feel that without a ban in effect in California condor territory, there will be no metric for success, thus dooming any chance of success from the get-go. And with regards to including the Southern Sierra at this time, I'd just like to mention that just because condors don't occupy the territory doesn't mean that they're not foraging in the area. Just a reminder that these birds can fly up to 150 miles a day on foraging missions. While Defenders is definitely not an anti-hunting organization, I would like to pose this question to the hunting community. Knowing that this is that there is a widely accepted fact that lead is a highly toxic substance that has been removed from products from gas to cookware, paint to pipes, and also knowing that hunters pride themselves on their strong conservation ethic, what kind of ammunition should they use when taking big game on which condors depend? Thank you.
Anthony Canales, who will have 4 minutes, followed by Gary Langham, followed by Don Saba.
Are you ready? I'm sorry. Honorable Commissioners, my name is Anthony Canales. I'm a resident of Granada Hills, California. I'm here as a private individual to, I guess, bring up some concerns that I have about the proposed alternatives. To be honest, Dr. Luft and Director Broderick have actually brought up some of the issues related to the concerns, which I have the printout of the PowerPoint in front of you, if you folks can look at that. There's also a little board with some ammunition, because in the last meeting on the streaming from AGP, there was some discussions about the ability to not identify or identify. I brought those here to discuss a couple of issues. To be honest, we're not going to go through the whole PowerPoint due to the time limits and the busy schedule. I just want to cover the summary. If I still have time and you folks have a question, I'll do my very best to answer it. And possibly we might be able to answer the lady's question about ammunition and the lead issue. Personally, I have certain concerns with some of the science, and this science seems to be justifying these alternatives. Next slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. If I believe that if you find certain errors, omissions, maybe lack of clarifications that are in the science or in the documents presented, that may be justification to actually postpone or study further or possibly even reject the alternatives. The summary of these concerns that I have that have come up through basically a review of various literatures, including the Sorensen Report, the Johnson peer review, a study called Hunt, which is the Peregrine Foundation study on bullet fragmentation. Another gentleman will be discussing the Church lead isotope ratio comparison study later. And the first concern has to do really with the prevalence of lead in the environment. As much as there seems to be the single focus on lead as far as lead ammunition, there's other environmental sources of lead that for some reason seem to be omitted from the literature on the subject. One of these is something that's going to be growing, and you folks will, one, be facing it, and two, you have regulatory authority over it right now. It has to do with the disposal of biosolids. Under the EPA Rule 503 permits Class A, or otherwise known as excellent quality biosolids, to be land applied in various areas throughout the state. There are several areas proposed for the South A zone alone. One of them, which is roughly at the intersection of Highway 119 and Highway 5 in the 10-year Taft. But the standard that the EPA has promulgated is 300 milligrams lead per every kilogram of biosolid, and the city of Los Angeles is currently scheduled to deposit 200,000 tons a year on a 4,800-acre parcel. That's just one biosolids operation, again, in the Central Valley. There's at least four others that I've been able to find through internet searching. Another issue of concern obviously has to do with some of this information in the studies. The staff seem to pick up on some of the issues about whether the data was complete or not. Again, the Church issue will be addressed. The Peregrine Fund study on bullet fragmentation. If you notice some of the bullets in front of you, one of those is the sample, is one of the bullets I believe was used in the Hunt study by the Peregrine folks to generate large numbers of fragments. It's a bullet that in the past us hand loaders have noticed that the bullet will fragment early. Nosler's done a pretty good job in trying to fix that problem, but there's still limitations on velocity and input. And when you hunt, if you load the charge too hot, or if the manufacturer runs the lot too hot, you can have excessive fragmentation as a matter of design. You've got some other issues about the processing in the x-rays. Let me move that while I'm sitting here. About the process of the x-rays were done for high contrast. That could have led to false positives through too much density in the negative. The Sorensen study, actually, everybody's still looking at it. I just found it just 3 days ago. A couple of observations. The issue about pigs.
Whoa.
The issue about pigs is there that for some reason they don't seem to be eating on pigs, that particular observation. The next issue here. The 2000 lead subcommittee report, this rush in a sense, we were told in the 2003 report that we'd have a 5 to 7 year hunter education period that seems to be getting cut short right now. And then another issue is this issue about a lack of actual scientific data proving that the non-toxics will actually perform the same way. There's a lot of anecdotes out there, but we all know from the duck experience back in 91 and 92, in that middle 90s period, there were a lot of cripples and regulations had to change. If you start wounding big game, you may have to change your management programs, and there's other problems related to that. The enforceability issue, Warden Foley talked about the inability to tell bullets in the field. I'm not sure how they do it with, say, all bismuth loads now because they're non-magnetic, but this is something that's going to be expensive. Plus, for law enforcement functions, the wardens may have a problem in having to carry more than one kind of ammo, one approved by FBI for, say, a DOJ-style operation, the other for the actual animal control issues they may have to do.
So you're going to need to wrap up.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Okay. There's other issues as far as the other paperwork. I've run out of time, but thank you anyway.
Thank you.
Gary Langham, followed by Don Saba, followed by Jeff Miller.
Good morning. I'm Gary Langham, Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, California, and I speak on behalf of our 60,000 members in California and our 48 chapters statewide. I can just want to make a few comments based on what I've heard today. I can tell you this is a very important issue to our constituents because last month we put out a call to our members to send a letter to the commission in support of the lead ban, and we had over 1,200 letters sent in, which is a very high number for our organization, meaning that our constituents feel very strongly about this. And I'm here to strongly support the commission's efforts to consider a lead ban in condor country. It seems to me that, as a scientist myself, we have a very rare situation here where all the scientists seem to agree on one thing. That doesn't happen very often with scientists. They usually argue with each other quite a bit. But all the published reports in scientifically peer-reviewed journals and all the reports that I've seen from the Fish and Game Department all seem to lead to the same conclusion, which seems to me also to be sort of the common sense conclusion that lead ammunition is strongly contributing to this problem. I also wanted to comment that we should think of success in terms of the 1996 Fish and Wildlife Service Recovery Plan, what they define as success, and that is to have at least two populations of 150 birds or more in the wild that are self-sustaining and one breeding population in captivity still. In California right now, we have about 70 birds in the wild, and it's interesting that we had a few births last month in the wild, and then we had three deaths in the same period, and so we seem to be sort of at a steady state where we don't seem to be able to build on the amazing success of the captive breeding program, which is more successful than we had ever hoped. We want to move beyond that 70 and get to the two populations of 150. And all the people who work on this in the field and all the scientists agree that lead ammunition seems to be the cause that's preventing us from moving to a successful goal. We've seen today from the report from the Fish and Game Department that there are spikes during the hunting season, and I think that should really seem very important to you as you notice that the lead levels were much lower during the other months. The lead isotope analyses that have been published strongly support the idea that lead ammunition is the leading cause. And in fact, I have seen no published or even incidental reports that suggest any other credible source of lead in condors. And I think I just want to reiterate that if I applaud the department for publishing or for showing us today that information, those summary statistics on lead levels, because they really are difficult in California to get. And I would urge them to try to make available those raw data so that the rest of us can have a chance to look at them. And in closing, I would just like to urge the commission to please do something this year to adopt a ban of lead ammunition in Condor Country. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Saba, who has 4 minutes. Jeff Miller, followed by Dick Dasman.
My name is Don Saba. I come here to speak before you as a scientist. My business is biotechnology and cancer research. I have extensive background in chemistry and in biochemistry and in medicine. And I'm here out of great concern for a paper that has been presented to you, the lead isotope study. This is bad science. I have extensively read this paper, and I've come to the conclusion that it is essentially shoddy science. Why? Well, they have eliminated a tremendous amount of existing data. Before you, you have my report, and please, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt. This is a very complicated issue. It's a heavily scientific issue. But the basic premises laid forth in the CHURCH study, the lead isotope study, are erroneous. They claim that the lead isotopic composition of lead from the environment is different from lead from ammunition. That is false. That is demonstrably false. And in fact, it is even shown by the very references in the CHURCH paper. If you actually read the references in the CHURCH paper, they contradict the CHURCH paper. Why is this? How could this be? I went and looked at the references, and I'd see a chart of isotopic ratios, and the CHURCH paper just chooses the ratios that make their argument and eliminate the other ratios. That's unconscionable for a scientist to do that. I have before you on page 3 of my presentation to you, I have a list in table 2 of the erroneous data from the CHURCH report, and below that I have table 3, which shows the data that was omitted from the CHURCH report. And you'll see a very narrow isotopic range being offered by the CHURCH report. Actually, you can see two narrow isotopic ranges, one for environmental lead and one for ammunition, in the CHURCH report. And you see those are at different levels. Whereas if you look at the references in the CHURCH report, they say, no, there are wide overlapping ranges for environmental lead and for ammunition lead. And so what we've got here is the CHURCH report has just arbitrarily omitted data that contradicts their position. This is not science. This is not acceptable to a scientist, and that's why I've come here to talk to you about this. The interesting thing about the data in the CHURCH report is it seems to suggest that the isotopic ratio of the lead that the condors are getting in their blood is coming from a very narrow isotopic range. Well, that can't be from coming from ammunition, because ammunition has a broad isotopic range. So what we're looking at here is the very data in the CHURCH report that they do present as their own suggests that the lead in the blood of condors is not coming from ammunition, not coming from the general environment, but rather from a very specific source in the environment. Now, I'm not here to speculate on what that is. But I did do a little research, and I can offer you this, that there is lead out there in the environment that no one here has talked about. There is industrial lead paint. Industrial paint has lead in it. It always has. The lead bans only apply to domestic household paint. Industrial paint lines the derricks of oil wells. It's any industrial building. It has lead in it. It's used because it can expand and contract without flaking. The lead on road signs, that all is exposed to the sun. That all is industrial lead paint. The lead on highways, the markings down the street, that's all lead paint as well. So we have a lot of paint out there that comes from a single source. And I'm only suggesting that there are other places lead can be coming from that you're finding in the blood of condors. Pretty good timing. Anybody have any questions on that?
I have a question. Dr. Saba, do you have any new data or research of your own to present, or are you just here to criticize the research of others?
I just became aware of this CHURCH report recently. So I am here to criticize this report. I don't have any data of my own. I just began looking at this. I can tell you, though, that I am dealing with the American Chemical Society on this, and I'm going to publish a paper debunking this. But I just got wind of this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Miller, followed by Dick Dasman, followed by Walt Manziel.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm with the Center for Biological Diversity. We're part of the coalition that petitioned this body in 2003, and we also have pending litigation regarding the lead poisoning of condors. And I just want to point out that our coalition does include hunters who have hunted and will continue to hunt in the condor range and literally are not going to shoot themselves in the foot. So this is, we are working with hunters on this, and some of our partners have an interest in continuing hunting in the condor range. I found the department's presentation today a little bit disingenuous. And for a number of reasons, but you've heard a lot about Arizona condor poisonings and deaths. And as was pointed out, the recovery program in Arizona has shared their data. They've published their data. Unfortunately, in California, it's been really hard to get any information from the recovery programs about condor blood lead levels, chelations, et cetera. And that's part of the reason you're hearing more about Arizona is because we have the information. In terms of the lead exposure, you got a presentation from Dr. Michael Fry before this commission, who is a toxicologist. He's an expert on lead poisoning, and he also prepared a report for you in 2003 on this issue, and he went over some of the very issues that the department is now claiming we don't have information on, and he very clearly linked human health and lead blood levels and condor lead levels and discussed why it's appropriate to link those. He also gave you a lot of good information on sublethal poisoning of condors and what the possible effect is. And he also told you that anything above 10 should be considered above background. And anywhere from 10 to 60 is what we should be concerned about. And he also pointed out that the deaths of condors that aren't listed as lead, condors that go missing, condors that fly into power lines, et cetera, that very likely are lead-related. An interesting statistic, the mean blood lead levels mean nothing to an individual condor that's above those mean levels. And we have had condor deaths from lead poisoning in California. We've also had, from that graph, we've had 30 condors that would have died if we hadn't intervened and saved their lives since 1997. The you are what you eat problem, you had Dr. Noel Snyder also testify before you. He's an expert on condors. He can tell you what they eat. They're not specialists. They're generalists. And the analogy is, you know, if I eat mostly vegetables, but once a month I go to the ice cream store and I eat ice cream and there's cyanide in my ice cream, it doesn't matter how often I eat ice cream. If the poison's there and I encounter it, it's going to kill me. The last point is that lead bullet fragments and shot have been found in condors. There's conclusive evidence that bullets are killing condors. The point here, I'll sum up, the point here is to recover condors. It's indisputable that the greatest obstacle to that right now is the lead poisoning issue. And, you know, until we there have been deaths in California from lead ammunition, and there will continue to be deaths from lead ammunition until we effectively regulate lead. Thank you.
Dick Desmond, followed by Walt Manziel.
Good morning. Dick Desmond, Arroyo Grande Sportsman's Club, also representing hundreds of sportsmen in the Central Coast area and several organizations. We want to emphasize that we are not opposed to non-lead ammunition. What we are opposed to is enacting this ordinance under such a time frame as the ammunition, the non-lead ammunition, would be unavailable to the hunters. I've contacted Barnes Bullets. You have a letter from them requesting a little more time. They are the largest supplier of non-lead ammunition in the country. You also have a letter from the Federal Ammunition and Company is their position paper, which I believe you should have received a month ago directly from them, which has a lot of pertinent facts for your review. As a former police officer, I'm aware that there are also issues involving enforcement of the non-lead ban. For instance, the Speer TNT 50-grain hollow point 223 bullet is in fact identical to the new Barnes varmint grenade in 223 caliber, and you will be unable in the field to determine which is which. So you have tremendous enforcement problems that are going to need time to resolve. In addition, you may have some problems with the substitute to lead ammunition, as they have in the Chicago area, and as they have discovered in a Virginia Tech study, that some of the replacement materials were far more detrimental than the lead, and they were unable to resolve the contamination issues because they didn't have the expertise that they had with the lead issues. As an avid sportsman and environmentalist, I would urge the Commission to delay implementation of this law until the industry has had an opportunity to address the availability and safety of non-lead ammunition, and the department has had time to develop procedures for enforcement that ensure compliance without infringing on the rights of ranchers and sportsmen. And I encourage you to utilize organizations such as ours to get the word out. That has not been done effectively to this date, although the department has taken tremendous strides in this area. And I submit this information, and thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
Walt Manziel.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, members of the commission, department staff. I talked to Jesse Trantham Tuesday morning. I've been talking with him almost every other day for the last 3 weeks. One of the birds that Mr. Bruneman alleged to that they were not sure of was clearly electrocuted. Jesse said it was a healthy, normal 4-year-old bird that got electrocuted, lost a battle with a power line. A second bird was found, a very freshly released bird, was found feet and wing spread and feet up, laying on its back in a farmer's field. That bird is in Portland for necropsy. No apparent cause, no injuries or anything obvious. The third bird, there's another bird in San Diego waiting necropsy. He is not didn't give any particulars on that one. For your information, they lost a wild hatch chick from the Baja population due to excessive nest parasites. Several times in the past meetings, a question of chelation cost has been asked by you members of the commission of various presenters. As far as Jesse Trantham knows, the only chelations are being done by the Los Angeles Zoo on a voluntary basis as part of their donation to the science as members of the team. No government agency that is part of the condor recovery team, to the knowledge of Jesse Trantham, has a line item, budget item for chelation treatments. He is unaware of any field treatments being done anywhere, but there is a possibility they have something new at the Pinnacles that he's not aware of, and we could not contact the people that we want to talk to. Mr. Pedersen is gone. We couldn't get a hold of Court Van Tassel over the last few days, so we don't know if they got some new wrinkle that we're not aware of, but Jesse was not aware of it. They do a field test for lead background. That's a rough test. If it's elevated, they bring the bird back for chelation treatment at the San Diego or LA Zoo, excuse me. And so that's the story on chelation. Yesterday, Commissioner Sutton commented on another issue, that it is not a good idea to pass new regulations until we've done an adequate job of trying to educate the stakeholders and get everybody on our side, get a consensus feeling on this issue. We have barely scratched the surface on the education possibilities in this issue. We feel very strongly that there's a lot of areas. Some have been emphasized. I compliment Dr. Loft on his presentation. It was very good, I felt, very honest, very all-encompassing. Some other areas you could look for is articles and exposure in outdoor magazines besides California Fish and Game publications. You could look for handouts at the sale, over-the-counter sale of pig tags, bear tags, A-zone tags, which are sold over-the-counter. Nothing goes to those people other than their big game booklet if they received one in the spring of the year. We feel CRPA cannot support a regulatory ban at this time until we have covered all the other bases and allowed us a chance to adequately educate hunters. We feel there will be an equal level of compliance by voluntary education as there will be from a regulation being passed that is going to be extremely difficult and costly to enforce. No one has mentioned anything here about the cost of enforcement, where the money is going to come from. If we look at the map that was in the book that the game wardens gave you yesterday, there is, by my count, about more than a dozen vacant positions on wardens in the Condor country right now. Who is going to man those things? Who's going to do the enforcement necessary? It's going to be extremely difficult to do that.
Thank you, Walt.
Thank you very much. Okay. Appreciate the chance to speak to you.
Thank you.
That wraps up public comment for today.
Commissioners? Comments, questions? Okay.
Only that I have always maintained that I had questions about the best available science on most of the issues that come before us, and although I've made comments that some of the science is in some instances has been hired by special interests to say what they want to say, and I'm not going to say that's not the case with the other side of the issue today on refuting some of the science we've already heard. But I've always said from the very beginning of this issue that it's obvious that led to one of the problems with the Condor, but there's not been sufficient evidence enough to prove that lead is strictly from the ammunition that hunters use. And I think there's something to the testimony that we heard today, that there's lead and other areas out there that the Condors are subject to being able to receive lead contamination from. The other, and I'm glad that Walt, because I was going to ask, who's doing the studies on the three birds that recently died, and how reliable are those studies going to be, and everybody in the room knows that we probably lost more condors from electrocution than any other reason, and so there's a whole lot of issues. We all want to do our part and saving the condor and getting it reestablished in California, but it's kind of the same to me. I mean, if that's true, that the studies and the demonstrations of lead fragments were used by identifying one bullet that releases more lead fragments than others, then that's what I call biased science and biased reports. To show a picture of a dead buck that I know darn well, there's not a hunter in the state left laying out in the field like that, and try to insinuate that the condors that are eating that buck are getting lead poisoning from it, are the kind of things that make me hesitate to think that we have all the information we need to make a decision. I think the department's report and information that they gave today leaves a lot of room for us to say what we said on other issues that have been huge and important to the entire constituency of California, and that is when we do make our decision, let's take the time to get it right and do it right and not allow lawsuits from constituent groups that don't get their way, or legislation from those same type of groups that can capitalize on a legislator to try to circumvent what this commission's authority is. So that's my comment, that we take the time to get it right the first time before we do make our decision.
Thank you, Commissioner Kellogg. Other commissioners?
I agree with Commissioner Kellogg. It's important to get this right. And I also understand that it's sometimes difficult to sort through a competing science. But I also have been around long enough to know that trying to discredit science without presenting new information is a time-honored approach to defeat conservation measures. And it's a recipe for doing nothing, taking no action. Especially, we've seen that in fisheries, and we're seeing good examples of that in other areas here. The way I usually sort through this is, my definition of the best available science is academic peer-reviewed science published in a scientific journal. Anything else is can be anything. Advocacy science, I don't care who hires the scientist, whether it's a group on the on any side of an issue. So what I usually try to do is look for research done by academic researchers that's been peer-reviewed by and published in a reputable journal. And it seems to me that that's pretty much a that's a reasonable definition of the best available science. From what I've seen of this issue, the science is conclusive. Where what we really need to get right is the implementation of whatever we do. And we've heard some good testimony today about the importance of doing that. There is no doubt that coming up with something that the hunting community can support is important. But from what I've heard, the hunting community doesn't support doing nothing either. So I look forward to a discussion of exactly what we can do.
Okay. Commissioner Hanna?
I think I've done my homework, and I've written a motion for the commission to consider. I'm comfortable with the options, all of which have been publicly noticed and evaluated in the current draft environmental documents. Therefore, I move to authorize staff to notice possible adoption of these regulations for the July 12th and 13th meeting in Bridgeport, with the intent that they become implemented on 1108.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor. I do believe some of the department's report showed a timeline in August, and I want to make sure we're Sankey or Director Broderick or Dr. Loft. Wasn't your slide suggesting a August time frame for the environmental document? Is that correct?
Correct. Commissioner Gustafson, the time frame we presented was assuming we would be recirculating the document. I believe
okay.
Commissioner Hanna's motion is to basically go to certification of the existing document. Which would allow it to be done sooner.
Okay, so within those options, you're comfortable
correct.
That the options you're going to support are within that. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, well then I'll call for the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No. And that being because of my statement that I think that we have to make sure that we take the time to get it right before we make our decision.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Kellogg. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the department. We had talked about this issue in Bodega. We also, then President Rogers and myself, met with some of the department folks and our commission staff to discuss the timeline and some of the options that were presented today. I want to thank you for an excellent response to that meeting and covering the issues that we asked to have covered in that report, and I appreciate you getting back to us in a timely manner. So I want to thank the department, Dr. Loft, Director Broderick, for making that happen.
I'd like to clarify with the department that, and for the commissioners, that before this could be adopted possibly at the July meeting, the environmental document will have to be certified final by the commission. So it will have to be in the commission's hands before that meeting, here at the commission meeting for public inspection, and then certified that day by a commission vote before adoption can happen. So does the department see any problem with having that here? I just want to confirm that.
I'm actually in the process of consulting with your most expert staff in APA process, making sure we can deal with the eyesore in the time frame because we have some dates we have to change. And it appears we can make that work for the July, getting a nod from your most excellent staff.
That works for me. My staff, I trust them.
Okay, thank you very much. Move on then.
Moving to item 21, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 704, Title 14, related to automated license data system, license buyer surcharge. This is a receipt of public testimony. I have one speaker card. The department was not planning on making any public comments. Is that true? So we have one public speaker on this issue. Do you want to hear that before discussion?
Sure.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I was strongly encouraged to speak on this issue by some of my compatriots, specifically on the veterans discount licensing. We have had a hassle for many years. Yesterday I turned in a legislative report out of one of the veterans magazines saying that any level of disability that a United States veteran has should be allowed a disability or a discounted fishing license. I myself, year after year, have to produce paperwork that's over 35 years old. I got out of the Army 35 years ago, and it has been a burden to me to have to dig up that paperwork and go in to get a license. And many of these private little sports facilities do not honor that, even though it's in the law. Now, with this automated new process, can we not have it on the computer that I don't have to dig up 35-year-old paperwork and take it in every time I want to get a hunting or a fishing license? This has been quite a burden. The other question is that new legislation has been passed that it's any level of disability, not this old 50% threshold. This is a real sticking point to millions of veterans in California, and it has been harped on for years and still not clarified.
Does the department have a response to Mr. Weakland's question? Is that something that the ALDS, I don't know if you heard it, Sankey, but the question was whether or not the records could remain on these disabled veterans so that within the system so they wouldn't have to am I stating this correctly, Paul, that you wouldn't have to produce your paperwork year after year?
Yes, and many of the private sporting stores don't honor the law.
Okay.
And we have to go to Sacramento year after year to renew our licenses.
Yeah, I'd have to check into this. Obviously, if it's a data storage and retrieval and management system, I don't see why ALDS couldn't deal with it. I'll report back to you at the next meeting specifically.
Okay.
Some of this may have a legislative angle to it, because if it's in statute that it be reported that way, then we'd have to change that. But I'll also report back to you at the next meeting on that detail.
Thank you.
The fact that the threshold with recent legislation has been lowered.
Okay. Thank you. So noted, Mr. Weakland.
That is all the public testimony on item 21. That moves us to consent calendar. Please remember that yesterday we pulled number 23 off of the agenda at the request of Mr. Kevin Lunny. So that's no longer on the agenda, will not be part of the consent calendar. Entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion we approve the consent.
Excuse me a second, Mr. Kellogg. I'm sorry. From a procedural perspective, it's important to ask if there's any public testimony on item number 2 regarding recommendations and requests to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections of Title 14 regarding albacore and bluefin. We're required to ask that. We had no speaker cards on this, but for the record, I want to establish that we asked for public testimony on this. Thanks.
Okay. Seeing none, then we'll go ahead with a motion.
I'll move the consent calendar with the removal of item number 23.
And
Do I have a second?
I have a comment on one item, please.
You want to remove?
Second it first. I'll go ahead and second it, but I'd like to pull one for a quick comment.
Okay.
The one I want to comment on is the Peregrine Falcon delisting information we got. And if what it says is true in here, if this is factual, I found it absolutely fascinating. We were down to two breeding pairs in California in 1972, I believe the date was. And I never thought this was a big deal because I got a breeding pair on my ranch, and I thought, I got one. I guess everybody has one. I find out that it's a pretty rare bird. But having said that, the parameters for recovery have been met 2x on this bird. If this is all truthful, and I find it fascinating, and I look forward to being able to see this one go through and take a bird off an endangered species list, because that's the only way you can validate the Endangered Species Act.
Thank you for your comments. Commissioner Sutton.
I'd like to follow up on that, especially since Director Broderick is here. Yesterday, we discussed the issue of who pays for the CEQA analysis for a delisting. I understand the rationale for requiring a CEQA analysis. You've got to make sure that a delisting is warranted and not being done for other reasons. But with respect to the peregrine, the brown pelican, and a lot of others, we need to figure out a way to facilitate these delistings that are warranted by the information available without causing private parties to have to pay six figures in CEQA compliance. Because otherwise, my fear is that nothing ever will be delisted and that the statute will be judged a failure because it never, you know, there's no way to ever get a species off the list. I realize this is a difficult issue because of the budgetary implications of it, but just wanted to flag that discussion for future reference.
Commissioner Sutton, commissioners, it is a quandary. The cost is extensive. The burden, that's not a good answer to provide to folks that are all in agreement. We have recovery, and they are folks that have been engaged in recovery. Let's celebrate success in many cases, years and years and years, and basic fundamental societal changes and manufacturing changes. But the reality becomes that there is no budget, six-figure budget, and we have tried to prioritize some of the ones for delisting. We are looking at whether we can use a programmatic equivalent that has been established under the authority of the Secretary of Resources. However, in using that, there has also been folks that have been concerned that has been abused. So it only takes one party to say, no, I want you to go back to a full CEQA analysis. And then, you know what CEQA is. It's a disclosure document, and anyone that feels a disclosure document is not sufficient for even the most modest of technical merits has recourse to remand it back through via the court to do it again. So we got to find some way to cut through this. We should be celebrating the incredible accomplishments we've made. And if we can't prove that the Endangered Species Act at the state level isn't a two-way door, then we absolutely frustrate what we do in campaigns and on a day-to-day basis to maintain the biodiversity and recover threatened endangered species and other species for that matter. So I agree, but I don't have a magic dollar bill for it.
Thank you. Director Broderick, we have a motion and a second. All in favor for approving the consent calendar items?
Aye.
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 Thank you.
That moves us to item 29, announcement of future meetings. July 12th and 13th, the Commission will meet in Bridgeport. August 9th and 10th, Santa Barbara. October 11th and 12th, Concord.
And as we noted yesterday, we're going to be looking at December 6th and 7th to be in Sacramento. I want to make sure that's so noted. Correct?
Staff will be looking at options in Sacramento and bring those back for possible approval by the Commission at the next meeting. Yes.
Great. Thank you. And with that, I believe we can adjourn. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Thank you very much.